Hello guys, Jack here from Jack Makes Happy Hour podcast, and yes, the rumours are true, we're heading back out on tour in May 2024. 68% of the tickets are already sold out, but there are still a few left at Edinburgh, Newcastle, Manchester, Birmingham, Leeds, Cardiff, Sheffield, Nottingham, Bristol, Bury, and our home city of Norwich. So, don't waste any time, grab your tickets today, and come and watch me, Alfie and Robbie live.
And me.
Mainly me, Alfie and Robbie, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
HappyHourLive.co.uk. See you in May. Who have we got coming up today? Stephen White.
Today, we have Dr. Shahom Das.
And he is a forensic psychiatrist. So let me tell you, Happy Hour listeners, it gets a little bit deep today, doesn't it?
It gets deep and incredibly interesting. I think this was one of those episodes where Jack and I kind of went off script for most of it and just kept asking what came to our silly minds.
He's a super, super smart guy, as you can imagine, which comes with the job title. I think we ask the exact kind of questions that you guys are going to want to know.
We spoke about some real, very intense and dark cases, such as Gypsy Rose Blanchard and Lucy Letby.
We spoke about how a lot of top CEOs, they portray potential psychopathic tendencies. Steve Jobs' name comes up. Mark Zuckerberg's name comes up. Are they psychopaths? Do you have to be to run a global empire?
We also spoke about what actually happens inside mental asylums.
I found that particularly interesting.
I found the whole thing interesting.
We spoke about mental illness in cinema, Joker, Shutter Island, and loads of other films. But guys, as you can imagine, this episode does get a little bit heavy in parts. Dr. Shahom Das works with real patients that are mentally unwell. So there are themes of murder, self-harm, mental illness, suicide, and real-life true crime cases. So if any of those themes are something that are potentially triggering for you or something you can't listen to currently, then feel free to give this episode a miss and come back on Monday when we'll be with the boys chatting absolute waffle, as we usually do. But these, Stevie, I think you agree, these are some of our favourite type of guest episodes, aren't they?
Yeah, I absolutely loved it. It was, what, 2 hours long, and I loved every moment in the studio with him.
Yeah, perfect. So, guys, enjoy this two-hour-long chat with forensic psychiatrist Dr. Shahom Das.
Jack Makes Happy Hour.
There's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Hello guys, welcome back to Jack Makes Happy Hour podcast. I'm here with my left-hand man, Stevie White.
Hello.
Looking good, you're losing weight.
How have you said that and made it sound like an insult?
I didn't mean it to be an insult. I mean, like, this year you're only drinking water.
Well, yeah, I have done since the start of the year.
You've been going gym a lot?
Yeah.
You're looking very good.
Thank you.
But you're not looking quite as dapper as our guest.
Oh, come on.
Our guest today. Right, Stevie, before I introduce who he is and what he's about, I'm a bit nervous.
Why are you nervous?
Because you can get in the minds of people.
Yeah.
It's Dr. Shahom Das, and he is a consultant forensic psychiatrist who works with mentally ill criminals. Is that correct, sir?
That is correct, yeah. Lovely to be on. Thank you.
What is that, first of all?
What the hell is that? Right, so a psychiatrist is a medical doctor who specialises in mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone knows that. A forensic psychiatrist like myself does that, but it's for people who have either committed severe violence or who have committed severe violence and either have been arrested or are on remand or on trial, and they either definitely have a mental illness or we suspect they have a mental illness. So I try and figure out what that mental illness is, how to rehabilitate them, how to treat them, basically.
Wow, what an interesting job. Do you love it?
I love bits of it. There's a lot of admin and a lot of paperwork. So for every one case that I see, for every hour that I spend with the individual in prison, which is the interesting bit,
yeah,
the evidence, there's probably 8, 9, 10 hours where I'm sat in a coffee shop looking through medical notes. So
the bit that we don't see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The behind the scenes stuff can be a bit tedious, especially when there's when somebody's been in and out of hospital for years and there's literally thousands of notes to go through.
Right.
That bit I don't love, but the actual, the piecing together, the puzzle bit I love, yeah.
I'm super excited for this, aren't you?
Yeah, I am. There's also, I don't know what you'd class this brain as, but that is a puzzle. So I'm interested to see what you think of him throughout this.
I'll take notes throughout and I'll come up with that. Are you a psychopath? That's fine.
Probably got elements. We did, didn't we do on an episode years ago? Didn't we did a psychopath test, but it's one of these novelty ones that you get online. How accurate are they?
I suppose they're as accurate as the information that's put into them, right?
Right.
So I'll answer that a different way. So when I'm seeing an individual patient that's in one of these secure units, and I have to see if I can diagnose them with psychopathy or not, we have the psychopathy checklist, and you've probably done a version of that. Asking the questions is relatively easy, but actually knowing whether the information is accurate or not is trickier. So you don't just take them at face value. You look at all their background information. You get objective evidence, ideally from like an ex-partner or a relative. You look at previous medical reports. So if you do all of that, then right. It's very accurate. But if you don't, if you just sort of answer questions quite superficially, then it's not accurate.
Yeah, there's a lot that goes into your work. You don't just give your patients a BuzzFeed quiz, do you? Right, we always start with the same way, Dr. Das. We would like to know what you would put in the Happy Hour Hall of Fame. So it's a fictional place,
okay.
Far, far away, or as close as right here in front of your heart. And you can submit an item, a place, a person, a feeling, a thing to the Happy Hour Hall of Fame. What would you like to put in there?
Okay, it doesn't have to be related to my profession.
No, anything you want.
Yeah,
good, because I don't really have anything physical that represents my profession. I haven't got an MBE like Vanessa Frake has. it's in the post, I don't know.
None of your research, I like this. And can we just say as well, a little look behind the curtain, one of... or potentially the only guest to come bearing gifts. So thank you for the muffins. It's very sweet.
I think in terms of physical possessions, the thing that I wouldn't say the proudest because I only bought it, but the thing that I enjoy the most is my full-size Street Fighter 2 arcade that I've got at home. So it's one of the very few things that I've actually argued with my wife openly about. So when she makes the decisions or anything goes in the house, I always listen to her. I got this thing. So I ordered it off the internet, right? And it had the inch sides. And I thought that it'd be about this big, but it was actually the inside screen. So it's like literally that big.
Oh, wow.
We got it. She was like, well, that's going in the outhouse, the pool table, all that other stuff. And I was like, no, I really think this is like a centerpiece. I think people of a certain age, especially men, love it. And so I put my foot down and it is there like in the middle of our sort of kitchen, at the corner of our kitchen. And it's good. It's like a centerpiece for people to come in and like men, especially like in their 40s, you can see them sort of eyeing it up.
Yeah.
You know, when you have like kids' birthday parties and stuff like that.
That's superb.
Bam, immediate.
Superb. I like it. It's in there. Did you ever play it?
Street Fighter, yeah. I think they're up to like number 6 now or something. It's obviously changed a lot since then. Is it like the full-on old...
Oh. Yeah, yeah. So like joysticks and everything, yeah. Yeah, it's got 1,800 games on it. So it's like a...
Oh, so it's not even just Street Fighter.
I'm sure it's illegal. It's like... the outside it has like Street Fighter characters, but I think that it's all like knockoff counterfeit.
That's unreal. We're putting
Big
it in
fan
there.
Of that.
We're putting
Big
it
fan.
In there. Now, before we get into psychiatry and all the stuff that's inside the mind, we want to get inside your mind, Shaham, and we are going to hit you with some quick fire questions to get to know the man behind the forensic psychiatrist, Stevie. Kick us off.
What is the weirdest app on your phone?
The weirdest app. So I've got all these. Basically, to entertain my kids, I've got things like Crossy Roads. You know Crossy Roads?
Yeah, I've played Crossy Roads.
What? Okay. What is it?
A game.
Is it good?
Yeah, it's kind of like a new version of Frogger.
Yeah.
Okay. Would be the easiest way to describe it.
Crossy Roads.
Crossy Roads.
You put a Y on the end of any word, I'm already interested. Makes it cute.
What, any word?
It's a very simple game, isn't it? Like you said, yeah. It's like Frogger. You just keep sort of pressing this little chicken that has to cross the roads. So my kids are 8 and 10 now. So I had it on when they were toddlers, when they were like, you know, getting agitated at lunch or whatever, out with people. You just give them the iPhone and it kind of keeps them occupied. So the things that surprised me about Crossy Road and worried me was how quickly my kids managed to do better than me. Mm-hmm. So, like get a high score. Like I can get maximum 100 points on that game. Cameron can get like easily 350.
Oh, wow. But can he beat you at Street Fighter?
No.
There we go.
You sometimes get lucky if you just Google it.
I've never played it.
Never played Street
Fighter?
Never
played it. Is it like Tekken?
The style game, Mortal Kombat?
Like 2D, like...
The old school ones.
Yeah, so you guys are, what, your 20s, mid-20s?
30, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Both 30, yeah.
I'm 45, right, so Street Fighter 2.
You look so good for 45.
Thank you.
It's annoying.
Wow. What a handsome man.
That's annoying because he's 15 years older than me and you started by going, you don't look as good as this man. Fine, it's fine.
You
I
had
understand.
A rough paper round though, didn't you?
I think it's a healthy living. But yeah, so for me, Street Fighter 2, I remember I was, what, 12, 13 when it came out? It was mind-blowing. It's so much more advanced than any other game before it.
Yeah.
It's probably not the same for you. Like, you'd be impressed if you saw it, but yeah, to what you grew up with, I imagine playing video games is probably not that big a step.
I've never had a go.
Did you ever play Mortal Kombat? That was my one. All over Mortal Kombat.
Nah. Didn't really play any games, apart from...
Until Call of Duty.
Call of Duty. And
Habbo Hotel.
Habbo Hotel, which we won't get into. What was the last series you binge-watched?
I think I re-watched Jessica Jones with my wife. That's the last one that I saw. The last one I saw that I rate that I really enjoyed was The Boys.
You know, I like The Boys.
Is that the one where they all have superpowers?
Yeah. You haven't seen either, have you, Jessica Jones or The Boys?
Have you seen both?
Yeah.
This man here has watched like every series.
Well, they're both superhero things. Jessica Jones is Marvel and The Boys is its own thing. The Boys is just mental, though. Yeah. Like, it's... Jack doesn't like any film, series, whatever, TV, if it couldn't happen in real life. So the thought of superpowers...
I'm weird.
Gone.
But I don't know if this tempts you or not, Jack, but it is obviously set in a fantasy world, but it's like what would actually really happen if real... So it's about power corrupting. That's what it's actually about.
Okay.
People who are... Like the supposed heroes of The Boys are actually really twisted, maniacal, depraved, like quite psychopathic as well.
But I quite like it.
So on the face of it, they're like Superman. Or the main character, Homeland, is like Superman, but behind the scenes, he's just like an evil, twisted bastard. That's what makes it so good.
Yeah, I do like it.
And it's gruesome. Like people are exploding, blood everywhere. Like it's quite intense.
I actually do like, genuinely do like the sound of that.
Give it a go, honestly. Yeah. It's really good. It starts like straight away. First scene, just wow, cool.
Oh, hang on. Fee, did we put this on once? Is it something to do with, and I could be completely wrong here, but does someone get split in half?
Yeah, yeah, that happens. I think that happens in a thing. I think one of the first things, this is a spoiler for the first episode, but beyond that, the main character's girlfriend gets killed pretty much straight away because there's a guy called A-Train whose ability is running super fast and he's going to something and she steps out on the street and he just runs through her and she explodes.
Fair enough. Shaham, do you like true crime? Because obviously...
that's a good segue to the chat.
Yeah.
I do to a degree. So I talk at this true crime event called CrimeCon. That's actually how I met Vanessa in the first place. And I am nowhere near as a big fanboy of true crime as the people that come there. So look, I'll give talks there and they'll come up and they'll ask me my opinion on what do you think about this serial killer and this murderer. I haven't heard of half of them. So I'm not like a really strong true crime fan, but occasionally there have been documentaries that come across my radar that I think are really well made.
Right.
So we were talking earlier about American Nightmare. That was pretty good. So it was amazing. Mm. Tinder Swindler, I thought was really well made. So to answer your question, I am to a degree. I wouldn't say it's one of my main interests.
Yeah.
They were made by the same people, weren't they? Tinder Swindler and American Nightmare, yeah.
That's interesting because you obviously work like personally with mentally unwell people. So these documentaries, like I always find like, I don't know, would I enjoy something that I do all the time anyway? Does that make sense?
Well, you listen to other podcasts, don't you?
Yeah, but if there was one that was super similar to ours... I wouldn't listen to a podcast that has... Well, we've just filmed an episode with Stump Peg. I don't think if a podcast came out in the next year with Stump Peg, I would listen to it.
No.
Because you've
done it, yeah.
Yeah.
One other thing I'd say is that true crime is quite hard to sort of dip in and out of quickly. Mm. So I watch YouTube all the time and I'll watch stuff like battle raps or stand-up comedy because you can watch like 5 minutes or 10 minutes and that's it.
Mm.
With a proper true crime documentary when they're setting it all up and trying to, you know, suggest who the different culprits might be and then throw off the viewer.
Mm.
It's a commitment, isn't it? It's like 45 minutes an hour minimum, if not.
Yeah, because they're so dramatised as well, aren't they? They can't just let you know all the information in an hour. They're like, this is going to be spread out over at least 3 parts. So you're almost committing to, if I'm going to watch this, I know that's 3 hours of my life that I'm putting into it.
Mm. Yeah. Fair enough.
What is your earliest memory?
What's my earliest memory? It's not particularly exciting, but I vaguely remember picking up, I must have been about 4 or 5. I was in my back garden. I used to live in Windsor, and I picked up a ladybird, and I just remember it crawling across my finger and flying off. And I remember being really shocked because I didn't know that ladybirds could fly.
That's a really cute answer. I like it. What's your biggest pet peeve?
Biggest pet peeve? I think that it is... I think it's when people don't follow through on what they say they're going to do, or like say they're going to send me an email and don't do it, or just anything where somebody says they do something and they don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
It happens in my line of work with, you know, clients, solicitors, other psychiatrists, but it happens more in my media endeavors. I think a lot of people are always really enthusiastic and say like, we're looking at these ideas and we'll call you back. And so I've had like umpteen chats with producers and everyone's like really friendly and enthusiastic. And then they say they'll check out my material and get back to me. And mm-hmm. just to be 100% clear, I'm absolutely fine with somebody saying it's not really for me. I'm not really that interested. That I don't mind that at all.
Yeah.
It's the opposite. It's when they kind of say that they're going to do something.
Promise the world. And
exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
That happens all the time in the media.
So a lot of that, isn't there? The amount of times that we reach out to guests and they say that we'll come on this date, and then 2 days before it's like, can't do it for whatever reason, then you never hear of them again. Yeah, so yeah. Now, Stevie, can you explain this?
The big red button. So the big red button, at the end of each Get to Know with our guests, we're now going to allow a previous guest to ask our current guest a question of their own. So when you press that big red button, it's going to set off this ball machine that you can see behind us. Okay. And a guest that we've had on the previous season is going to ask you the next question. So feel free to press the button.
Oh, it's working. It's working. Oh, God. Is it?
Give us a ball. There it is.
You'd be surprised how temperamental that is.
I need to stress, Jack and I have not seen any of these questions, so we do not know what's coming. We're going to allow...
Shaham to open it. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so...
You need to open it.
Look, they can be tricky. I don't want any guest to be embarrassed by not being able to open it.
Stevie, I'm nervous about this.
Oh, please don't be... Is it actually?
Do you watch porn?
No! What? Right, we're going to have to explain something here because this happened before the podcast started. Oh my God, this is not a stitch up, I promise. I promise it's not a stitch up. Right, so we have about 30, 40 questions in there, listeners, right? And as Stevie said, we genuinely haven't seen any... I cannot believe it. We genuinely haven't seen any of these questions. They get wrapped up by the guests and they get put into the ball machine. We don't see them. The one that we saw was Michael Van Gerwen's because it was so weird. And it's, do you watch porn? Michael Van Gerwen. So we put it in anyway to honour it. And I said to Shaham before we started recording, there's one that's fucking weird. And if it comes out, we'll redo it. We're not actually going to answer that. And we're going to throw this question away. It's probably a good thing that we've got it out now.
Sorry, MVG, but...
It's a weird question. It's a weird question.
Should we get a different ball?
Let's reload it. Let's do it again.
Oh my word.
Did you think we were stitching you up for a second?
Oh, two.
Two questions.
Okay, the one's going back. There we are.
Okay.
Pass it over.
Thank you.
Yeah.
They're just all filled with MVG. Is this more a bit... Is this one okay?
Do you watch porn? It's from Alex Zane. What is your unpopular movie opinion?
There we go.
A film that's rubbish that you love, for example. Okay, I'm sure there's loads of these. The one that comes to mind, you know Wolverine Origins?
Yeah.
Everyone slags it off. Everyone says it's like really shit and it got something like 40% Rotten Tomatoes. I think it's a decent film.
Is that the one with Ryan Reynolds as Deadpool for the first time, right at the end? Or is that a different...
Yes, yeah, it is, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, and he's fighting Sabretooth and there's loads going on up there.
And conversely, everyone seems to rate Logan, you know, the last one where he loses his powers and he dies.
Yeah.
I just think that was a really boring movie.
You're not a fan of Logan?
No, because it's really depressing. I'm not saying that there's an issue with a movie being depressing in general, but it's a superhero film. I don't want it to be like a really dark, deprived tale of somebody sort of losing their power and eventually dying. And also, he doesn't have powers for almost all of it.
Mm.
So I don't want to watch a superhero film.
Where he's not even a superhero.
Exactly, especially with a character as cool as Wolverine. I want him to be able to do all the Wolverine shit and heal and stuff like that. So
you seem to have a massive love for superhero films and TV and whatever. Do you think that's just because it takes you so far away from the reality of life, especially when yours can be quite dark, the things you're looking into?
Honestly, no. I think I've just got a slightly immature taste and sense of humour.
So. I'm exactly the same, so I'm all over that.
Street Fighter in the kitchen.
So, you know, Street Fighter, I mentioned before, I listen to, you know, one of my favourite things is battle rap, watch those stand-up, so... When I go to psychiatry conferences, I have different interests to most of my peers. Let's put it that way.
Oh, I like that.
I always have. I don't think it's got anything to do with my job. But.
Yeah, love it. I kind of wish that I enjoyed superhero movies, but I just can't.
Give the boys a go and then come back.
Is that like dipping your toe in the water? Like, if you like that, then
it's just more. It's more of a reality as to what could genuinely happen if there was a way of giving people superpowers.
Yeah.
This would be potentially how it would go down.
Is Joker a superhero movie?
Yeah, I think that's borderline.
Well, it's a supervillain origin story, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's probably just about in the genre, but it doesn't really have any powers.
Yeah, there's no powers.
It's one of my
that.
Favorite movies.
Yeah, yeah, I love Joker.
But then
yeah.
I guess you like
a YouTube video about that as well.
Have you? I'll
send you the link.
Oh wow! Oh yeah, I'm 100%
psycho analyzed like how he became the Joker from a forensic psychiatrist.
We've got a few questions about that later on.
You don't mind Batman either, do you? Because he doesn't have powers. So you quite like the Dark Knight, don't you?
Yeah, he's just like a sort of rich Tory, isn't he?
Yeah, big fan.
What do you think of, have you seen The Batman, the new one with...
Robert Pattinson.
Yeah.
No, is it good?
No, I thought it was really dull, really dull.
Really?
Really like the Christopher Nolan ones, but this one I just thought it was really boring.
I never watched it because I heard a lot of people just say it was really dark, so I was like, I can't bother.
The worst film I think I've ever seen in the cinema was Batman vs. Superman, because it was just 2 hours of... Just that, all the time.
See, he can't.
Say something, have a narrative.
He says, Martha.
It was just
the whole thing.
I would have had as much fun, I'd have had more fun going outside the local Weatherspoons and watching two drunk people scrap. Generally, I think I would have.
Fair enough.
But let's move on from movies. Let's move on to you, sir, okay. And your life.
Yeah.
As we explained, you're a consultant forensic psychiatrist, and you did give us a sort of brief description of what that is. Can you tell us in detail, like, what's your day-to-day? What is your job?
Yeah, yeah. So there's different environments that forensic psychiatrists work in. Mm-hmm. I'd say the three main ones are within prisons, within psychiatric units, and as an expert witness in court. So mm-hmm. I've been an iteration of all of those things in the past, but right now I'm doing expert witness work because I just personally find it the most interesting. So what would happen is that if somebody's on trial, if they either definitely have or are suspected of having a mental illness, then their defense team, the defense always gets to go first. So they find a psychiatrist such as myself. I've been doing this for about 10 years, so I've got good relationships with certain solicitors. So they will reach out to me, they'll send me a case and they'll say, you know, this is what we think is going on. And they'll send me all the information and I can accept or reject a case. Give them a quote, number of hours, blah, blah, blah. Less often I'll get instructed by the CPS. So that's the other side, the prosecution. The reason why it's less often is because defense always gets to go first. And it's only if the CPS doesn't agree with that report that they want their own opinion. So it's actually a very small proportion of cases, maybe sort of 10% of cases.
Yeah.
So I say yes or no, depending on how interesting the case is, what my workload is like, how far it is as well. And then what I will do is I will look at all the information. So I look at all the evidence from witness statements, CCTV footage of the incident, the police transcripts of the interview when the person's been arrested. So I've got a picture of what their mental state was like. Then I assess them. It used to be in person, but I have to say since COVID, a lot of it is remote now. So prisons have their own sort of secure version of Skype, which is good in a way because it's more convenient for me because you have to mess around waiting to get into prisons, which is an absolute ball ache. It's like getting into an airport. It's that kind of level
oh, really?
Of security and
right.
time. But it also means you don't have the kind of feel of sitting in the room with somebody,
mm-hmm.
Unless I request to do that specifically. So anyway, so I will assess them, have basically do a mental state examination as a psychiatrist, try and tease out the symptoms. Then I write a really detailed court report. And if the other side don't accept it, then I'll, which is quite rare actually, then I'll be called up to give evidence in court. That's basically it.
I don't know if this is a stupid question, but what's the difference between a psychiatrist and a psychologist?
Yeah. Not a stupid question.
It sounded like you were going, yeah, that's fucking ridiculous.
How dare you ask me that?
I'll leave. You guys carry on.
So there's a big overlap, right? So psychiatrists such as myself are doctors first. I have to go to medical school. You have to qualify as a doctor. You have to work a couple of years as a junior doctor outside of any subspecialty. And then you can specialise. As you'll know, there is like, you know, surgery, GP, oncology. These are all different specialties. Psychiatry is a specialty of medicine. And then once you've done that, once you've started training that, you can subspecialize the different subspecialties of psychiatry. Forensics, being offenders was what I do. Child and adolescent, old age psychiatry, suicide attempts, which is like liaison psychiatry. There's lots of different types. Whereas a psychologist doesn't learn about the whole human conditions. They're not medical doctors. They only deal with emotional issues. I'd say that psychiatrists only deal with mental illness. So we will deal with anything from schizophrenia to, you know, depression, suicide attempts, bipolar, whereas psychologists can do mental illness, but they also deal in emotions. So it could be, you know, confidence building, sports psychology is a huge one, grief. So they're not mental illnesses. They're just the human condition. In terms of our powers and abilities, psychiatrists can do more, I think it's fair to say. So I can prescribe medication. I can section somebody.
You just pointed that out, by the way, for the audio listeners.
That's not spasm that
happened. I think that's mainly at you. But...
I haven't decided yet. Whereas psychologists don't have the power to detain people. I'd say that psychologists generally have more time with their patients. So they're the ones that would sit down on a, well, they don't actually sit on a couch, but would sit down in a room with you for an hour a week and talk about your problems. Whereas psychologists, a bit like a GP, they kind of oversee your mental health. They might prescribe, but they don't generally have the time to sit down with you for hours at a time because our caseload's so much bigger.
So you mentioned there that you had to just, do doctor school, right?
study.
Yeah, which is like the sort of like broad spectrum of it, and then you find your specialist after that. How far through that process did you realise, or did you go into it knowing where you wanted to sort of end up, where you are now, or did you learn that along the way?
Yeah, the honest truth is I had absolutely no idea what I wanted to do going into university. So I went to Edinburgh Medical School. To be blunt with you guys, I didn't take it particularly seriously. I just kind of coasted through, failed quite a few exams. Didn't have to resit a year because I just about passed all my research.
Coasting through medical school is still probably better than the majority of people who couldn't even get into medical school.
Yeah, but you can, if you cram, you can get a lot. You can just about pass exams if you cram without actually learning any of the source material.
Right.
Which I learned at my, because in your finals, you can get asked anything about anything. So when I got to my finals, were in year five, in my fifth year, and I got through about halfway through my fifth year, this is a bit of an aside, and I was doing like a clinical attachment. I was a medical student with this junior doctor, and she was asking me, I remember this like stuff about reading ECGs, chest x-rays. I didn't know any of it because I've crammed for my exams for years. And she basically said, there's no way you're going to pass your exams. Like, you're probably one of the worst medical students I've ever seen.
Oh, wow.
And it was just such a wake-up call to me. And I just went home and I was like, she's right. I can't remember any of this stuff because I crammed, because, you know, my memory's not amazing.
Yeah.
And I did just the minimal amount. So I just kicked myself up the ass and I spent 6 months like studying all the time every day to basically make up for 4.5 years of not studying.
Yeah.
So I managed to pass my exams. But yeah, sorry, to answer your question, Jack, I didn't really connect or feel passionate about anything to do with medical school until I did psychiatry, which is in my fourth year. So I worked in a psychiatric ward in Edinburgh, and I just found it really interesting to talk to the people that were there. So for a start, you get a massive range of patients. So if you go to a cardiology ward, they're pretty much all going to have very similar things. You might have one young person with like a rare cardiac disease, but 90% of the people are going to be elderly people with heart disease. You know, it's very, very similar.
Yeah.
Whereas in a psychiatry ward, you have everything. You have like, you know, suicide attempts I mentioned before, eating disorders, people with schizophrenia, people with like paranoid delusions, people with post-traumatic stress disorder, just such a sort of rich, diverse presentations. So that's one thing. Another thing is that it's just fascinating because you get to ask them anything you want about their background. Just like you can ask me anything as a guest in your podcast, but you can't do that in real life to somebody you just met. Most doctors can't really ask personal questions about a background, whereas a psychiatrist, you know, for the right reasons can. So you really get to know the individuals. And if I'm being honest, another reason that I went into it was because this psychiatrist is really nice. They're a lot friendlier and nicer than, for example, surgeons who are like, a lot of my friends are surgeons now, but they treat us like shit when we're medical students because they're so busy and it's so intense that we're just an inconvenience to them. We're not somebody they want to teach. Whereas psychiatrists that I've worked with, especially when I was a medical student, have always been really approachable and friendly. That made me want to learn about it.
When you tell people what you do, and you've got a great YouTube channel where you speak about all sorts of which, by the way, can I just say your YouTube channel name is one of the best names for a YouTube channel. Can you tell our listeners what it is, because it's brilliant?
A Psych for Sore Minds.
Good, isn't it?
I do like that.
Two puns in one.
I like that thing. See, smart man.
I'm a sucker for a pun, so if you double pun me, I love it.
Double pun me.
Do you find that when you tell people what you do, they see the kind of like, and this is definitely the wrong word, but the kind of like glamour of it, like the seediness, like the true crime aspect to it?
Yeah, yeah.
What's been one, I'm butchering this question, but what's been like
biggest misconception?
No, like what's a fun case? I don't know if that's harsh to say, because obviously there's a lot of people that go, but what's a... Right, let me... Right,
are you trying to ask?
So you clip that out, because...
You get another question from there.
Are you trying to ask? Yeah. You know when you go up to someone and go, what's your favourite true crime case?
Yeah.
But you're going, should you have a favourite... Like, or who's your favourite serial killer?
That's kind of, yeah.
But you're trying to go, what's a case that you are very, very interested by? Yeah.
That you worked on. Yeah.
Even though it's dark.
Yeah.
But not fun. We don't use the word fun.
Yeah, because later on we're going to be talking about the...
Ball didn't even come out.
Yeah, it was just like, you sort yourself out, mate. But it was like, because later on we're going to be talking about Shahom's like biggest sort of craziest cases and stuff. But I just want to just like right off the bat just say, give us an example of like some of the stuff you'll be tackling.
Okay, just a brief...
That makes sense. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I can do that.
Fucking hell, 3.5 minutes to ask that one question.
We're getting good at this. It's only been 5 years.
400 episodes, and that's how I are. Sorry, go.
Okay. I can't narrow it down to one, but I can give you a very quick summary of a few of them. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, so one that I've made videos about and really sticks in my mind simply because I've had very similar cases to her is a woman called Andrea Yates. This is a tragic case. I probably should give her... a viewer discretion warning to your viewers. So she, in 2001, I believe, in Texas, she killed her 5 children. She was completely psychotic. She had a history of mental illness. She had schizophrenia. There was loads of really bad treatment that she got from a previous psychiatrist. They basically didn't take her concerns or her presentations particularly seriously. They made stupid decisions like taking her off medication without like doing any follow-up to check how she was. And she became psychotic and she drowned and killed all of her children individually. Didn't try and hide it. She literally phoned the police afterwards and said that she'd done this because she had these delusional beliefs about the children being marked by the devil. And I've seen three cases very similar to that in my career. I haven't killed 5 children, but I've killed 1 kid each. Mm. So that is something that really sort of sticks in my mind. It's kind of that's the reason that I do what I do, because when you've got somebody that's that vulnerable, that's that mentally ill,
right?
Obviously there needs to be consequences. They need to go into hospital. I'm not saying it should be released, not, but I also don't think they should go in prison because she's mentally ill. She needs like treatment. She is suffering from symptoms that can be relieved. And I think as a society, we have an obligation to try and treat that. So that's one that jumps out to me. Anders Breivik. So you know the guy?
Yeah, I know the name. In Norway.
Yeah. The reason I find him fascinating is because there's a bit of a schism between psychiatrists of what his diagnosis is. So some people say that he doesn't have any sort of psychotic illness. So he's not out of touch with reality. He's just a nasty piece of work, probably got a personality disorder, but he's not, you know, he knew what he was doing. Mm-hmm. Whereas other psychiatrists, interestingly, when he was initially assessed, the 2 psychiatrists, I believe it's 2, from Norway said that he was actually psychotic. He did have psychotic beliefs. And I think, I can't prove this, but I think that that's so unpalatable because what he did was just so horrific that I think the courts basically said, we don't really like that opinion. Let's just get him reassessed until we get the opinion that we want.
Oh, really?
That's what I think happened, because it just seems weird to me that the diagnosis suddenly changed.
Right.
So I'm fascinated by that case. Obviously, I've never assessed him, but I'd love to just get to assess him in person to see what I think.
Did you have any sort of more quote-unquote normal jobs before you went into this?
I mean, so I worked as a junior doctor in a few different specialties. So I did A&E for a year. I worked on medical wards. Before that, I was an auxiliary nurse. So I did that in the holidays for money. So just like, I think they call them healthcare assistants now. Mm. I've worked in a pub for the summer before I went to uni, and that's the only jobs that I've done. Yeah.
See, this is what fascinates me, because you deal with such extreme and complex cases now. Like, how do you become sort of battle ready, if you know what I mean, from going from a pub and being a junior doctor to then sitting down with these criminals that have committed such sort of like heinous crimes?
Yeah. I'm not sure there's really an answer to that. You just got to have a certain disposition, I think it's fair to say. Mm. So I think that a lot of doctors are not particularly that interested in psychiatry because it feels probably wishy-washy compared to something as very kind of regimented and clear as surgery or medicine, number one. And then forensic psychiatry, I'd say, is even harder, is even more kind of Marmite, because you're dealing with, you know, damaged and sometimes angry, aggressive people. Mm. So you have to have a certain disposition to be able to kind of face that in the first place,
right. Action
from the individuals, but also knowing the heinous things they've done, from killing strangers to, you know, sexually abusing children. Mm. So to answer your question, you've got to be sort of ready for that. And I suppose because I get to read all the case notes and everything, I kind of know what's happened to a degree. Does that make sense? I'm not completely blind when I'm going into an assessment. I know what they've done.
Yeah.
It's not like I find out when I see them face to face what they've done. I've already got all the details in advance.
Is it then hard to remove your personal sort of emotions when you meet someone? Like, is it, before you answer that, actually, Shaham, if somebody gets like a not guilty by reason of insanity, is that them getting a lesser sentence then, sort of thing?
No, not quite. So that is one of the exact psychiatric defences that I give evidence for. And it is very rare. That's the first thing I'd say. So probably when I'm asked to assess it, I probably only agree with that defence in maybe 5, 10% of the cases. So the vast majority of the time I say that psychiatric defence isn't open. But no, so it means that you're not guilty in the eyes of the law. But if you've done something, if you're still risky, if you're deemed to be a risk, so I already mentioned, you know, I've assessed women who've killed their own children, then they would be, upon my evidence, they'd be sectioned to a mental health unit, to a secure hospital. So you're not guilty. So it doesn't go on your medical records. You don't technically get punished, but you get sectioned to a hospital for long-term rehabilitation. And the amount of time that you're in hospital is completely up to the forensic psychiatrist who looks after you. So if you get better really, really quickly, potentially could be released within a year or two. If you've got, like, Andrea Yates, a good example, she's got a really treatment-resistant disorder. So even after years and years of medication, she's not improved very much. So she's been in since 2001. And in fact, as a bit of an aside, she actually could have been released a couple of years ago, but she asked to stay in, I think probably because she's got all these, you know, guilty feelings and doesn't want to be let out in the community. But the point I was trying to make is that the length of stay in one of these hospitals is completely unrelated to a sentence for punishment. It's all to do with how quickly you're rehabilitated.
Wow, I found it fascinating, don't you?
Yeah.
What's the toughest moment you've experienced in the courtroom? No, that was what I was going to ask you, wasn't it? Is it hard to leave your emotions at the door when you're meeting people like this? Because you know how, like, are you here, child killer? You instantly, like, you feel all these negative connotations to that, which is correct way to feel. But
yeah,
can you park them and go in with your work mind?
Yeah. The honest answer is I think I'm exceptionally good at separating those two things. And I don't think the logical thing would be to say that, you know, I've been doing this for years and I've become hardened. That's not actually the truth. The truth is I've always been able to do that. I've always been maybe very mildly psychopathic. So I'm just able to, I don't get bothered emotionally by things. I don't get easily stressed out. I don't have that much of a fear response, I think. And so that's one thing. That's my natural personality. The other thing is I'm very clear in my mind what my role is, right? So my role is never to decide if somebody's guilty or innocent. It's only to help the court understand their psychiatric problems. Mm-hmm. So do they have a mental illness? Yes or no. If they did they have symptoms at the time of the killing or whatever the offence is? Yes or no. If they did have symptoms, did it affect their criminal culpability? So did they know what they were doing or not? Yes or no. And if they're not criminally responsible, then what kind of hospital do they need to go to? What level of security? I have to make those decisions. Outside of that, I am very aware that nothing else is up to me, right? So because I know that, and I go into an assessment thinking that, I don't perseverate on the horrific things they do. I have faith in the court system that the judge will do his job and the jury will do their job. And I think most forensic psychiatrists are like me, but I've definitely seen some who are very emotionally attached to cases. Either because the perpetrator's done something horrific, like killed a stranger or, you know, abused a child, or actually conversely, because the offender is actually quite vulnerable, like these women who, you know, are facing life sentences but are clearly mentally ill.
Right. How much time do you tend to spend with a patient? Like, are you with them for quite a long period, or do you just have a set load of questions that you need to get answered and then move on?
Yeah, so in the work that I do now as an expert witness, when I assess them for a court report or for evidence, it's a fairly short period of time. I'd say maybe 1 hour for most cases, maybe 2 hours for a murder case, because you just have to go into so much more detail. But in a previous iteration, when I worked in these secure units, it'd be that person's journey further down the line. So if they don't go to prison, they go to hospital, I'm the person in charge to rehabilitate them. Obviously, I've got a team of nurses, psychologists, and, you know, occupational therapists, etc. But then you get to know them intimately. So they're on the ward for typically 2, 3, 4 years, sometimes longer than that. And as a psychiatrist, I wouldn't go on the ward every single day because I'd have clinics and prison visits and stuff, but I'd probably see them once or twice a week over a really long period of time. So you get to know them really intimately. You get to meet their family, and that's part of their rehabilitation.
Have you ever found yourself actually liking people that you know have done bad things? Because obviously you're only seeing this version of them. You're not seeing the version that did something horrific. Yeah. So have you ever found yourself thinking, oh, they actually seem like a nice person?
Yeah. So I would say that this is a really sort of simplistic way of looking at it, but it kind of helps summarize things. is that you get people who have like a psychotic disorder where they do something that's completely out of character, like Andrea Yates, and behind that they're not a bad or nasty or aggressive or hostile person on one end of the spectrum. And on the other end of the spectrum, you get people with personality disorders. So there's things like psychopaths who are intrinsically, I wouldn't use the term evil, but they're intrinsically antisocial. So they're impulsive, they lack empathy, they just can be quite difficult, let's put it that way, and everything in between. So to answer your question, Stevie, I think that I would, it's easier to like people who are psychotic and you know, completely disconnected to what they did. And the thing that surprised me in my line of work is that you never, it's really hard to predict what somebody's going to be like. So sometimes I read what somebody's done and you come in and the person sitting in front of you is actually quite unwell and they're quite vulnerable and they can barely speak or they're really sort of paranoid or they're hearing voices and they don't seem aggressive. Like what they've done might be.
Yeah.
But they probably just did it in a lash of paranoia. You know, they might have stabbed their own mother or sister.
Yeah.
Not because they're bad, angry people that want to hurt them like longitudinally. It's because in that moment they were so unwell they didn't know what they were doing.
It's a bit like that. Is it Ed Kemper who... Is he the
one who killed his mum?
Really, like, he's really good at talking. He's really articulate, isn't he?
He's quite charming.
A lot of serial killers, I think, have been shown to be on the higher end of the IQ, haven't they?
Ted Bundy was smart, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think a lot of them seem to be on, like, the, like, brain-wise, seem to be quite smart people.
So we got nothing to worry about.
Yeah, so, nothing going on here, don't worry, you're safe.
Have you ever become attached to somebody that you're working with?
Yeah, I think I probably have. I think I've, the honest truth is, I think especially when I was young, when I first got into it, so when I started in forensics, like specifically forensics, let me think, it would have been 2010, is that right? So I'd have been in my 20s, yeah, or maybe early 30s. I think that I cared about whether people liked me or not too much. So I was trying to be a bit pally with some of the patients that were on the ward.
Right.
And I quickly learned that actually you shouldn't do that. And there's a reason you shouldn't do that, because you're not their friends, right? And also because you have to set boundaries. So if you're getting on with somebody really well, and so like on some of the, you're encouraged to spend time with the patients, you play pool with them, you have lunch with them sometimes on these secure wards. If you become too friendly and too pally, you're the person that has to say no to them further down the line. So you're the person that has to stop their leave if they didn't come back in time, or you're the person that has to increase their meds if they're becoming more paranoid or hearing voices. You're the person that has to give them a telling off, or, you know, basically set in boundaries. So you can't be too, it's much, much harder to come back from that if you're too pally.
Right.
It was like really personal to me and to that patient. And I think I learned that the hard way, in that those people that I really got on with and I wouldn't say I was friends with, but I was pally with.
Yeah.
And then I kind of realized that actually that's just going to shoot you in the foot. You have to be a little bit kind of stone-faced. You can be polite and nice, but you can't be too friendly.
That's just another reason why I couldn't do what you do, because I think I so want people to like me. And if someone's like a bit cold to me, I wouldn't be able to get my head around that. I would like try and actively.
Yeah. It's quite similar to what Vanessa Frake said to us about how she had to treat prisoners. And then same with Raphael Rowe, actually. When he's been going into prisons, he'll meet these people and find out what they've done, but he's always having to keep himself disconnected from everything.
Yeah.
That's such a hard thing to do. I think if you can't do it, you just can't do it.
Yeah. You know what? I genuinely do think, at the risk of saying extremely patronising, I think age has got a lot to do with it as well. Because I think my outlook, you guys are 30.
Yeah.
My outlook at 30 was very different from it is now.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Maybe it is age, maybe it is just the job that I do.
Yeah.
We're doing something where we just need everyone to like us as well. We're so desperate for attention. so with that,
I'm desperate for attention.
Yeah. I know you murdered your mum, but what do you think of me?
Yeah.
Are we all right?
Yeah. And also, like, I think I'm quite easily, like, I trust people too easy. So it's like, I'd read the case notes, so it'd be like, murdered his own mum with a shovel. And then I'd go in there and it'd be like, oh, I like your glasses. I'm like, mate, you're a legend.
He's actually a really nice guy.
Not guilty by reason of insanity. Let me.
Have I heard this wrong? Or did you say you have elements of like being a psychopath? Did you?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I've got a couple of very small elements in that I think I lack fear and I'm not sort of emotionally affected by things.
Okay.
I wouldn't say I lack empathy. Do I lack empathy? I don't like empathy for people that are close to me and that I care about, but I would say that I'm quite cynical in general.
Right.
I'm quite like that. All of those things, I think I'm a bit like that. You know I'm not an emotional person. No, I'm really bad with emotion.
If I accidentally chop my hand off now,
I'd be like, that's gross.
How are you react? That's gross.
Well, that's not nice. I don't think I'd feel the fact that you're in pain. I wouldn't want that to happen to you, but I don't feel like, oh, he must be in a lot of pain right now. I'd just be like, oh, I'll probably get that sorted. But I don't know. That's what I mean. Like, I really struggle. Like, people crying around me, I really struggle with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I can't feel what other people are feeling. I don't know how to, like, I almost feel like I'm pretending to have to.
Yeah.
Is he a psychopath?
No, I think you and I are probably quite similar, Stevie. So the reason that we're not psychopath, I don't know enough about your background, but I assume the reason that you're not a psychopath same as me, and that despite that, we don't sort of manipulate or con people. We don't like...
Yeah, I don't. I like to think I don't, yeah.
We're not like parasitic on other people as well.
No.
So if you're not those things, you're not a psychopath.
What do you mean by parasitic?
So a true psychopath is parasitic in their lifestyle. So they use other people to get things. So they will go out of their way to, I don't know, not pay rent, or use their friends to expand their social circle.
Oh, fuck. Care about. I am.
Yeah, I am then.
No, you don't use it. I'm using you.
Oh yeah, but then also like...
Nah, you get rounds all the time. You're decent.
Yeah, but I mean, like, what about in terms of like, oh, this YouTuber, do you want to come on the podcast?
No, that's our
job. Give a shit about their life. Oh,
don't say that, because they're not going to come on there.
Just the side.
Yeah, but that's the job. That's your job. That's different, isn't it?
Have you seen the film Saltburn?
I watched it the other day.
No, yeah. I haven't seen it yet. I've heard a lot about it. I've heard a lot about the bar.
I really, really liked it. But I would say he's a perfect example, the main character. I can't remember what he's called in the film. What's he called in the film?
I can't remember. I know the actor, Barry...
Yeah, Barry Keogh. Yeah. But whatever his character is, it's a perfect example of, first of all, a psychopath, because he's so sort of... Because he slips under the radar. He's a comedian. You know, you can't even know he's a psychopath, which is exactly what a real psychopath is, number one. But number two, his parasitic lifestyle. So he kind of leeches off other people.
Yeah.
Worm his way in there. So that's what I mean by parasitic, using other people.
You hear like psychopaths are often portrayed in film a lot, aren't they? Like in The Shining, you've got Jack Nicholson's character, you've got Leonardo DiCaprio in Shutter Island, Joaquin Phoenix we're speaking about in Joker. For you, because you brought up Saltburn there, film do you think has like really nailed it for you when it comes to like mental illness portrayal?
So do you mean psychopaths specifically, or do you mean mental illness in general?
Whatever way you want to tackle that, really.
I suppose the one thing I would say is that people misunderstand psychopaths all the time, right? In fact, you know, you asked me what my pet peeves, one I forgot to mention is, as a mental health YouTuber, is seeing people getting it wrong on YouTube, and they call people psychopaths in films incorrectly. It's far more often than they get it correctly.
Right.
So specifically, a psychopath is not necessarily somebody who is violent. It is somebody who is, it's more about being charming and manipulative. If violence helps your cause because you're a thug or a drug dealer, then that's what psychopaths will do. But it doesn't have to be. A psychopath is more about somebody who manages to, as I said before, slip under the radar, pretend that they're normal on the outside, but will stab their best friends in the back to get a promotion. So they don't have any empathy for anybody, including people that they're supposedly close to, including their spouses, including their kids. So to answer your question, a good depiction of that would be this guy from Saltburn, because you don't know that there's anything wrong with him on the outside.
Yeah, no one else could see it. Mm. As viewers, we could, but yeah.
And I suppose, I mean, this is a bit of a cop-out because it's a very similar film, but just one that pops to my mind is Talented Mr. Ripley. That's a perfect example of somebody that's using his surroundings and the people around him and lying and manipulating and pretending he's something that he's not. That's what a true psychopath is.
Right. And I guess a misconception that I probably hold about psychopaths is that, to echo what you said, like, aggressive, wild, and eventually end up in prison. But are there like millions of psychopaths that are just walking about day to day that will never commit big crimes? Yeah. Or will they all sort of eventually go on to commit crimes?
No, it's the first of the two. Absolutely. There's loads of psychopaths. In fact, I'd probably say there's more psychopaths that either haven't committed a crime or are under the radar of the police. There's more of those than there are people, psychopaths in prison, right? So about 1% of the population is psychopaths. So I suppose that means technically there's what's the population of the UK?
It's about 70 mil now, isn't it?
So whatever, 1% of that.
700K?
Yeah. But I suppose some of them are kids, aren't they? So they'd have to be adults. So maybe sort of 300,000 odd.
So when you say people wrongly call people psychopaths, is that where people, you know, I hear a lot of people either going, well, they're either a psychopath or a sociopath.
Yeah.
So what's the difference between those two things?
Mm. Yeah, I'll explain that. Just before, I just want to say something quickly. Mm. You probably know this, but psychopaths are massively overrepresented in the corporate world, right? And the reason they're so successful, the reason why they rise to CEO level, is because they will do anything for promotion. They will, you know, lie to or about their colleagues. They will stab anybody in the back. so they can actually thrive in that kind of world. You get psychopaths that do jobs where a lack of a fear response is helpful. So first responders, surgeons are overrepresented with psychopathy.
So would Jeff Bezos, is there a likelihood that he'll be a psychopath?
I don't know enough about him and the way he treats people. The one that comes to mind is Steve Jobs possibly could be a psychopath because he was like pretty horrible to other people. He would do whatever it took to meet deadlines and treat his workers like shit. So I'm not saying he's definitely a psychopath, especially because he's dead.
Yeah.
But he definitely has some of the traits, yeah.
I don't know
about Jeff Bezos.
Yeah. You hear similar stories. How true they are, I don't know. But there's there's the stories that like Amazon workers have to... wasn't there like a...
Peeing in the bottles.
Peeing in the bottles because they're not allowed toilet breaks. And
was that his doing or was that...
I think it's filtered through from him. I think there was the famous story, again, not sure if it's true, but the famous story of a pregnant woman who was told she wasn't allowed to go because her waters had broke and she gave birth in the Amazon warehouse and stuff. I don't know.
So I suppose if he knew that and he allowed it to happen, then that's definitely somebody indicative of traits of psychopathy.
Right.
I only know it from, is it Jesse Eisenberg's portrayal in The Social Network? But Zuckerberg, how you've been explaining it, comes across as a psychopath in that film.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say he has those tendencies? Because he seems to be jumping on
top.
Yeah, obviously, we're only seeing an acted version of it, but the everything he did to his business partner and everything is out there, isn't it? Mm. He won money off him and whatnot. So if that is to be believed, surely he's showing those tendencies.
I also don't want to get sued by Mark Zuckerberg. Just for the camera, these guys put me up to it.
And like we said earlier, one of my favourite films is Joker, the Joaquin Phoenix portrayal. And I had to Google this, I'll be honest, but he has a... it's a disease, apparently.
Cerebellar palsy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what we see with him doing the sort of uncontrollable laughing.
Yeah.
How common is that?
It's very rare. So I've only ever seen it once in my career, and it wasn't the reason that somebody was in our psychiatric unit. They had tics and OCD, but they happened to have it as a comorbid disease. So just by coincidence, they had this. So it's very, very rare. So do you want me to give you my 2-minute sort of summary on the psychoanalysis of...
Yeah, please.
So I've done a video on this on my YouTube channel, which is why I kind of know about it. It's that I would argue that it's not, even though despite how it's portrayed, it's not mental illness that drives Arthur Fleck to become Joker. It's everything else surrounding that, right? So he's got this pseudobulbar affect, palsy it's called. So he laughs uncontrollably. So that leads him to being beaten up. It leads him to being mocked. There's so many things on the outside that are happening to him. He just goes through a series of traumatic events. I'm sure you know it all, from being beaten up and mugged by kids to losing his job, on the background of having a severe head injury. So I think that's really relevant because, as you might know, people with severe head injuries can become quite disinhibited. They become quite aggressive if it's in a certain part of the brain. Plus he experienced abuse himself from his stepfather, possibly from his mother. Then all these other events come in. So he has an identity crisis, thinking he's, what's Bruce Wayne's dad called?
Bruce Wayne's dad?
Thomas.
He thinks it's Thomas Wayne's son, and then he gets kind of disowned by him. So I think it's layer upon layer of all of these traumas that makes him finally snap. He feels like he's nobody. He feels like the world isn't taking him seriously. And then he kills these people on the train. And for the first time ever, he gets respect from the community, and he kind of stands up for himself, and he realizes that the only way that the world will pay attention to him and stop being ignored is by being this sort of maniacal beast. So in summary, it's not, I don't think, mental illness that causes him to become the Joker. I think it's a couple of neurological diseases. So the pseudobulbar palsy thing is a neurological, it's to do with your nerves rather than your emotions. It's neurology. Psychiatry, head injury, and all of these events made him this kind of supervillain, not mental illness. That's what I think.
Wow. What an analysis. I can see why you do it for a job. You're pretty good at it.
He's done this before.
Yeah, he's done this before. How accurate? You said you met one person that was suffering with this. Is that correct?
Yeah.
How accurate was Joaquin's performance of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think his entire performance of that film was exceptional. It was pretty accurate. This person that I remember was in a secure unit and would laugh fairly maniacally. Probably not as often as Joaquin was doing it once in a while. It's not too dissimilar to Tourette's. It's kind of like a tic that you can't control, but it's just laughter rather than a swear word.
What is the and this might not be something but with Tourette's, what's going on there? What's the science behind that?
Yeah, I don't know too much, to be honest.
Right.
I know there's certain prefrontal cortex, it's called, a certain aspects of the brain that kind of wired wrongly.
Fair play.
Another film that gets a lot of props for the acting from the audience is James McAvoy in Split.
Seen that.
Have you not seen it? All over the internet, like, people tend to think he's incredible in it. So I think he's schizophrenic in that film. He's got multiple personality disorder.
No, he has split personality.
Split personality, but he's got quite a few different...
He has 23 different personalities, and they're 23 different alter egos, aren't they?
Yeah. So I would have been intrigued. It would be cool for you to watch it, because as a viewer, he's very good at playing the different personalities, but I'm intrigued to know whether he's good at doing... the mental illness side of it. Obviously, we're just seeing all these personalities, but whether that's a true portrayal of it is hard for us to judge.
So I can answer that to a degree. So I've seen like the trailer, so I know the premise of the film, and I know that he does, as you say, sort of jump between these characters. The one thing that I would say is that dissociative identity disorder is the technical term for multiple personality disorder, is extremely rare, and I've never seen personally a credible case of it myself, but I've seen several people who've tried to fake it. So probably about 5 or 10. Well, probably closer to 10 people over my career that have tried to fake it. So I'm not saying it doesn't exist, because I think that would be a bit arrogant of me, but I'm saying that I'm very skeptical about most of its presentation.
Right.
And it tends to happen to people who have had horrific, repeated trauma and abuse. So unless you've got that in your background, it's almost impossible to have that disorder, which is one of the reasons that I'm skeptical about the patients that I've seen, because they've had some form of abuse, but not to that degree.
How do you say to someone you're lying? Like, about, like, if are they going as simple as just going hello, and then suddenly they're going, this is John now? Like, is that what they're trying to do, because they've seen it in a film? Yeah. Going, that will get me off.
There's this I'm not going to name it because it's not fair, but there's this podcast I watched a couple of years ago, quite a big podcast, and they had a guest on who was this girl, and she said that she had split personality disorder, and that she would on days on end would change to be this young boy. And it was quite bizarre, because obviously when you're not used to that, I found it quite bizarre. But she then said, she spoke about the trauma that she'd suffered when she was younger with paedophiles and stuff, and it was horrible.
Yeah.
But watching it, I thought, to put it bluntly, and who am I to say this, but I didn't believe the split personality thing. I was like, it seems like a coping mechanism for something that's happened. And then,
can I ask, did she flip between the personalities during the podcast?
No, she didn't. Not during the podcast.
Okay.
I don't think. I think I would have remembered it. But then her partner later came out and basically said that he hadn't really seen that. If that makes sense. There was a bit of me that thought, like, I've never seen a documentary or something about it.
I think strangely it's one of the things I've never seen a documentary about it, but I've seen it in films all the time. There's a film called Identity. I don't know if you've heard of it, but I think that's quite good. I can't describe it because it's a big plot twist, so it'd ruin it, but I thought that was quite good. But as an entertainment thing, but I've obviously never actually seen, like, I'm surprised I've never seen a documentary on someone. You see it in films all the time where they're talking like one person and suddenly talking like a different person.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm surprised I've never seen an actual documentary about it.
It's a really intriguing thing, isn't it?
This might interest you. So there is I'm trying to remember the name now. I'm sure his name is Kenneth Bianchi. He was a serial killer in California in, I believe, the 70s, if you're able to look that up.
Yeah, got it here, Kenneth Bianchi, in born 1951.
Serial killer, kidnapper and rapist.
Yeah, span of crimes, 1977 to 1979.
He had a nickname, something Hills Murderer or something.
Other names, the Hillside Strangler.
That's one, right.
And so. Kennifer.
Okay, so this is a perfect example of somebody faking it. So I'm trying to remember all the details now. So he was a serial killer, and it turned out that it wasn't just him. It's him and his cousin, I believe, that were going around killing all these women in California in the 70s. And he tried to fake multiple personality disorder. And he basically got caught out by a clever psychologist who kind of just basically tricked him by saying certain things like, there's no such thing as having two personalities. It has to be a minimum of three for the diagnosis to work, which is bullshit. And then suddenly this third person. And then the psychologist said, you should, if you've got this disorder, you should be able to remember these details, but not these details.
So he just kept saying it, and then he's suddenly making up all these extra things.
So he wrote in his report, this guy's like, this.
Wow.
But there's never been a confirmed case of somebody definitely having split personality.
Not that I should answer that by saying I think there has been, but I'm not fully convinced how. I would need to see it myself to be fully convinced. I'm like an agnostic
I think I only know it from films. Like Psycho's the same, isn't it? Psycho, because he dresses up as his mum and then kills people when he's dressed as his mum.
Yeah.
So that's is that why he's called? I don't know the original Psycho.
Right.
I know I've seen the Vince Vaughn one, which is a weird version of it. But and then is that why he was called Kennifer? Because his other personality was maybe called Jennifer.
I
guess that was why his nickname was that.
Right.
So I'll just quickly say this. In the cases that I've seen hundreds, possibly even thousands of cases where somebody's psychotic. So they have like a paranoid belief that's incorrect and that's why they've attacked somebody. I've seen that loads of times, but I've never credibly seen somebody that's completely switched from one personality and doesn't have any of the thoughts, emotions or memories of another personality. So I've never seen that.
Right. Have you seen Shutter Island?
Yeah.
What's he got in that?
I suppose he would have a psychotic disorder. So he'd be psychotic. So out of keeping with reality.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think if he had a split personality. I don't think he did it.
No.
Or is he completely fine?
Because it's the is he fine or is he... Yeah. And it isn't... The lobotomy thing. Was that a thing that genuinely used to happen to try and cure mental illness?
Yeah.
Can you explain to me what a lobotomy is?
it's completely barbaric. So it's removing either the prefrontal cortex or the connections to it. You can either literally cut the head open and make incisions, or they used to put an ice pick in the corner of the eye and smash it with a hammer. So basically it's a very, very blunt tool. I said this in my lad Bible thing. It's kind of like trying to fix a water leak in a house by blowing up the whole house. You get rid of the water leak, but you pretty much destroy the house. So in that way, you can get rid of a mental illness, but you pretty much kill the personality of the patient. Completely barbaric, completely unacceptable. But back in those days, I think this was what 40s or something, 50s. Mm. There weren't clinical trials. Like if one psychiatrist said it worked, then people
give it a go.
Because they did electroshock therapy as well. That used to be a thing, didn't it?
Yeah, it still is a thing. So I've given that myself.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So
I've only seen the intense version in like American Horror Story and stuff. So
that gets a really bad press, but it's actually very effective in very severe mental illness. So it is effective in the depression that's so severe the individual's not eating, so their life is at risk, or if there's an acute suicide risk, or if the patient's so sort of manic and frenzied that they're really, really agitated and they're at risk of hurting themselves. It basically, it's not as bad as, it's as blunt and as unscientific as a lobotomy in that it doesn't work on one specific area. It just sends a shock through the brain and it makes the individual have a seizure. But it can reset some of the chemicals in your brain to get rid of that disorder temporarily. So it's not a quick fix solution.
Right.
But if somebody's literally at risk of dying and nothing else is working, then it can save lives. I've seen it save lives. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So I used to do that when I was a junior doctor. I used to the electrodes and stuff.
So if you looked at somebody with mental illness, let's say a schizophrenic person and somebody with a sane brain, And again, listeners, if I don't word this like in the most sort of PC way, then I apologise. I don't really know what the correct sort of terminology behind it is.
Are you asking looking at the actual brain or a scan of the brain?
If you're looking at the scan of the brain of a mentally unwell person and a well person, are there differences? Can you tell?
Not really. No, there might be very small changes, but they're quite non-specific, so it's not particularly that helpful.
Right.
The truth is that psychiatrists are not. Don't fully understand how mental illnesses are caused. We have some clues, I'll be specific. So antipsychotics, drugs that stop the symptoms of schizophrenia or lessen the symptoms of schizophrenia, block dopamine receptors. So logically, it follows that there's dopamine hyperactivities in more dopamine being processed in the brains of people with schizophrenia. So we kind of, we have insights, indirect insights like that, but it's impossible to actually look at like microscopically at the chemical changes.
Right, okay. But they don't know. Could we just become schizophrenic at any point?
It's possible, but it's very, very unlikely. So it's usually, first of all, it's usually connected with a family history. So it's usually mental illnesses that run in the family. So it's not impossible for somebody to not have relatives and to get it, but it's very unlikely, number one. Number two, it usually comes out in your late teens or your early 20s. So it'd be unusual for somebody at the age of 30 to develop that.
See, even that's fascinating to me. Like, why would it come out
just
at
suddenly
that time?
Come on.
Yeah.
But a lot of the time things like that can be through trauma, can't, like as in like actual physical trauma, I mean, rather than previous emotional trauma.
It can be both. So I think it's kind of like lots of different risk factors. If you've got enough risk factors, if you have the family history, if you've got trauma, if you have like been the victim of abuse, all of these things slightly increase your chance. And so if you have enough risk factors, then it will come out in some people, but not other people. Drug use is a huge one, you know. So like really some drugs more than others, amphetamines, skunk cannabis, really dangerous when it comes to schizophrenia. Alcohol, not so much. Heroin, not so much. So it's not all drugs, it's specific.
What can cause it?
Yeah, yeah. So if you've got a predisposition to it, yeah. It would cause it out of nowhere. But if you've got a familial or genetic predisposition, it can trigger it. Yeah.
Are there any of those kind of drugs that help mental illness or not?
What, in terms of illicit drugs?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you, like ketamine infusions, I'm sure you've heard about them.
Right.
Again, they don't work in the long term. They only improve symptoms like depression for a very short period of time, like a few days.
Yeah.
It's not something that you can use to cure somebody of an illness, but it can help you get over the edge if somebody, for example, is suicidal.
Is that what makes it addictive? The fact that it makes you like get over depression, essentially, like because people are going, wow, that made me happy.
Mm. Yeah.
So they'll keep going back to it.
It's more of a psychological addiction than a physical one, yeah.
Yeah. Shahom, I read a book once.
Well done.
I don't believe you.
He does know, he's in there. He knows.
Was it Where's Wally?
Can get past the first
page. It was about a very hungry caterpillar, let me tell you. It was called The Psychopath Test.
Okay.
Have you heard of
John
it?
Ronson, yeah. I read it a long time ago, yeah.
And in it, and again, I can't quite remember it because when I read, I don't take it in. There was a guy who went in, did he convince people that he was mentally unwell to get an easier sentence? But now he can't get out of the mental institution that he's in. Have you remember this case?
Not really, no.
Right, but how easy is it for people to? It was kind of like a did he, didn't he type thing. So a bit like Shutter Island again. How easy is it for people to convince others or people in your profession that they're mentally unwell?
Yeah, good question. So I would say it's very hard, and I'll tell you why. So I preface that by saying probably once every 2 or 3 months, I assess somebody who I think's either overtly faking mental illness or more often exaggerating symptoms because they want to get psychiatric defense. It's really easy to tell. Firstly, because I look at all the evidence before I see them, right? So if they're telling me that they were, I'll give you an example, say if there's like a stabbing in a pub after an argument, right? If they're telling me that they were hearing voices telling them to stab somebody, but I've got all these witness statements from everyone else that was in the pub, and I've seen CCTV footage, and the assailant was acting completely normally, was normal during the police interview, doesn't have a history of mental illness. It's possible, but it's highly unlikely that they're actually hearing voices. So my bullshit radar's on quite high alert. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing. The next thing is I find out how they are now. So if they're on remand, I'll speak to the prison guards. If they were already sectioned in hospital, sometimes that happens. If they seem to be really unwell, then I'll ask the nurses around them. And you're just looking for consistency. And I think that people in general are really bad at faking mental illness because they go with these Hollywood depictions like, Split or like these things. Mm-hmm. They try and force it. So another way of saying that is if you were actually really psychotic and you were paranoid and you've never met me before, you would not open up and tell me that you're paranoid because you, as far as you're concerned, I'm probably part of the conspiracy. So people who are really mentally unwell, it's the opposite. You actually have to tease out their mental state and they're really quite reluctant and guarded and evasive. Whereas when people try and tell you almost immediately within the first few minutes that I'm hearing voices or that, I'm crazy, then I don't believe them.
That makes so much sense. And I would have never even thought of it that way. Is it the same the other way around? So are mentally unwell people able to convince you they're not?
I would argue not. I suppose I wouldn't actually know if that's ever happened or not.
Right, yeah.
But I would argue not because... So I suppose it depends on the context, right? If you're talking about a one-off assessment where I'm seeing somebody as an expert witness and my job is just to write the report so that it can be used in their court case, then I suppose they could potentially keep it together for an hour. It's definitely doable.
Yeah.
You might argue why they'd want to do that because it'd probably be working against them.
And what reason would, I guess it's if they're trying to get out of a...
They've done their time in the mental unit now and they want to get out.
That is slightly different simply because that's not a one-off assessment.
They're under surveillance.
Oh, okay.
That's not being watched 24 hours a day by nursing staff.
So they'd have to really put some effort into...
Well, I'd argue, put a different sort of spin on it. So part of being a forensic psychiatrist in a secure unit is deciding when individuals are allowed to leave or are safe to leave into society. And you need to do that because there's a constant pressure on new people that have to come in, even though they're in for a long time, as I said before, 2, 3, 4 years, sometimes longer. Mm-hmm. at the same time, there's other people in prison that need to come into those places. So there's always a pressure to discharge people when you can, right?
Right.
And when you discharge somebody, obviously you're getting, one of the main things you do first is get rid of their mental illness through medication. That's pretty standard therapy to really drill down the reasons they offended. So is it drug and alcohol issues? Is it anger management? Is it misogynistic views? What can we fix through therapy, or what can we change through therapy? Those are the two basic things. After that, it's all about observing their behavior in the ward. So do they push boundaries? Do they get into arguments or into fights? Even though they're not prisons, there's a prison vibe in some of these units because a lot of people have come from prison. So there's people getting into the spaces, there's potential arguments and nurses setting boundaries, like people's bedtimes, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of opportunity to lose your temper. So if you manage to maintain your boundaries and not lose your temper, not get into fights, not give positive urine drug screen tests, and you go on leave. So you start off with a small amount of leave, just half an hour a day, escorted with a nurse, and then it comes to unescorted. And then if they're functioning in the community and they're doing constructive things like going to internet cafes, education, you know, going to college, all of these things from the hospital on leave, they do that for long enough, then in my mind, they're ready to be discharged, and you have to take that risk.
Yeah.
And I know that there is a proportion of patients that will go out and offend again, but you can't just keep everybody locked indefinitely, because otherwise, what's the point of trying to cure them in the first place, right?
Yeah, that must be so tough then.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big responsibility, and psychiatrists get it wrong. Every 4 or 5 years, there's a story in the newspaper of somebody that's been through that and then has gone on to kill. It happens.
Yeah.
It's inevitable because the people that we deal with,
yeah,
you know, they're already at high risk of reoffending. But to answer your question, Steve, in my view, if you can do all of that for 6 months, then it doesn't matter whether you're faking it or not.
It's like you've done it, yeah.
Can all mental illness be treated?
No. So there's two ways to answer that. So one would be that I've seen patients, so I worked at Broadmoor for a while, who are so unwell that even though they've had pretty much every combination of antipsychotic medication that you possibly can give, their delusions remain and they just can't get better, and I can't see them ever leaving hospital. The best case scenario for them is stepping down to like a less secure unit for the rest of their lives. That's one thing. Outside of people within these units, some diseases like schizophrenia tend to relapse and remit. So people eventually will relapse at some point. Right. But so not all of those like that. Some mental illnesses can be relatively short-lived, but not all.
You said you interview mentally ill people all the time, and you go into these psychiatric units. Again, my only reference point from that is watching these films, and they're quite extreme sometimes of what's going on in there. How accurate are those films to mental hospitals? I'll be blunt about it. We imagine loads of people running around, crazy people, animated people.
Headbutt on walls and stuff. That's what you get in, like, as I said, American Horror Story did a whole series of inside, like, a insane, I think it was called Asylum.
Yeah.
And and they portray it as, obviously that was portrayed for like 60 odd years ago or whatever, but they portray it as like everyone's just completely,
or like one flew over the cuckoo's nest, I think.
So my answer to that would be it's quite variable. So obviously for them to be in a psychiatric hospital in the first place, they have to be quite unwell, right? And there's always a pressure to discharge people when they're better. Even more so in general adult wards, so not wards for offenders, but in your average normal psychiatry unit where people go who haven't committed any violence, who are not necessarily dangerous, there's a big pressure to discharge them because you're intruding on their lives by keeping them in, and because there's just such a need for spaces. So the point I'm trying to make is that you won't have anybody on the ward unless they've got some sort of fairly significant illness. So by definition, the people there are quite ill. In terms of their presentation, it's really very, very variable. So I think in the movies that you're talking about, and I've seen them myself, they always seem to pick manic patients who are just like uncontrollable and frenzied, and there's definitely some of them. So on an average ward, I would say probably from my experience, roughly about 2 or 3 people will be like that out of, say, maybe 15 to 20 people.
Would they be allowed to spend time with the other patients, or is that too much of a risk?
It depends. So there's different levels of wards as well, different levels of security. If somebody's like actually overtly violent, then no, they'd be in a secure unit with a lot more nursing observation. If they're really agitated, they go into a seclusion room, which is kind of like, I suppose, the equivalent of a padded cell. It's not a padded cell, but that's what people think it is. But if they're relatively well, then they'll be encouraged to kind of mix with other people. But what I was going to say is that one thing that you very rarely see in these programs is the depiction of people who are severely depressed, because it's not that exciting TV, and they might be really withdrawn, might be really isolated. Sometimes they don't come out of their bedrooms, or if they do, they kind of sit in the corner. Or people with like chronic schizophrenia, they have these negative symptoms, like a lack of energy, lack of like interactions. They're really socially withdrawn and isolative, so they don't do very much. you know, in some of the wards I've worked in, there's literally people, and you know, you've got to feel sorry for them because they're, you know, tortured with these symptoms, and they're just literally sit on the chair and do nothing all day. Like, you could leave them and they wouldn't move until like you came and took them to bed or took them to a meal.
Wow.
So it's not too dissimilar to like intense dementia. I mean, it's not the same thing because they don't have memory problems, but that's their kind of volition, their kind of their inability to do anything. So I'm just saying that because you don't really see that in the films. You just see the agitated people.
We have the perfect guest to speak to about a question we've asked on this pod a few times. Mm. How do people with a mental illness that may cause them, well, I assume, or a psychopath that causes them to do something horrific, meet someone else willing to do that with them?
Yeah. Like Fred and Rose West.
Yeah.
Like how like if any of my friends came up to me and went, oh, I really want to do this, I'm going, what the fuck?
They all seem to meet someone. Yeah.
But how do they meet someone else like-minded? Because it's a rarity, obviously, for someone to be willing to do something so horrific. But you see it so often that these they can work in pairs or
types in,
So how does that happen? Is it just pure chance, or is it one kind of grooming the other to become that?
Yeah. The honest answer is I'm not sure. My best guess would be that you don't go and say, I think we should become serial killers and we should go out and kill these people. You probably take little steps and you make little suggestions like, wouldn't it be funny if we beat this person up?
Play it off as a joke.
But if you keep pushing boundaries, I think sometimes Fred and Rose West, I think it's fair to say that Fred was like the driving force and Rose just did what he told her to do. Mm-hmm. But I think in other situations you get a dynamic of, so you know Brianna Gay, so she was the transgender girl who got stabbed. I think it was a while ago, but the court case was very recently. It was in the papers.
I may have heard about it. I'm not too sure.
So there's a boy and a girl. I don't think they were named initially, two teenagers, and it feels like they were both sending each other messages back and forth, and they'd planned this thing in advance. They met her on the internet. But it felt like they were both sort of almost playing chicken of who could suggest the most aggressive, horrible thing to do to impress the other person.
Right.
So I think sometimes it's that. It's who will back away first.
Makes sense. Do you ever get scared going into these psychiatric units and having to be around these people?
No, I've been punched in the face twice in my career.
Have you? That's going to be my next question. Have you ever been attacked?
Two different people,
but very eerily similar situation.
Oh, really?
It's very weird. So the very first time I went onto a forensic unit, not that I'd want to sort of stigmatise mentally ill people as being violent, but literally the very first time I went to a forensic unit, got punched in the face on the first day.
Did that put you off?
No.
We're coming back. Come
not.
On.
I wouldn't be here, right? Both times were by men who I didn't know, who I'd never met before, who were transfixed by me for some reason compared to anybody else. One was in Australia because I worked out there for a bit, and one was in North London where I started my training. And I'd literally walked on the ward. Both of them had psychotic beliefs. One of them I never got to speak to, so I don't know what it was about, but the other one, so he was kind of I was basically trying to show off. So I got there, it was my very first day, and I wanted to impress my consultant. I was a junior doctor at the time, so I went in early and I started interviewing my patients so that at the ward round I can show off and say, you know, I've been to blah blah blah. But stupidly I didn't take any safety precautions, so I didn't carry an alarm with me, I didn't ask the nurses if it was safe and who was agitated. And I've learned obviously you have to do that now. And there was this one man, the guy who punched me, he just seemed like really preoccupied with me. So even though I was interviewing somebody else, he kept like looking at the window, and he wasn't being threatening. He was just like looking at me, and he'd open the door and he would ask really bizarre questions. Like he thought I was some sort of friend of his from school, and he was like talking about this cricket match we played. None of it made sense. And I just didn't, I don't know what he was talking about. So I kind of dismissed him and ignored him. And then I came out of the interview room and he basically ran up behind me and slapped and like punched me as hard as he could on the side of the head. And I didn't even see it coming. I was literally from the side.
Wow.
So I kind of woke up on the floor. I think I lost consciousness maybe for a couple of seconds. And in Australia, it was similar. Somebody, I hadn't had any interaction with him, but he ran up to me and also punched me in the side of the head, I presume because he had some delusional belief about
it. Did you ever speak to the people afterwards, or was it just that?
Because I was actually one in Australia, it was literally a night shift. So I was just walking through to prescribe medication for somebody. So I had no involvement with that ward or that patient. I told the nurses, and to be honest, they didn't seem that bothered at all.
Very much like he's done it before.
Yeah, we're on break. but the other time in North London, it was the ward that I worked in. That was my first day. So I was around him for like the next 6 months. And he was unwell. You know, like, I didn't take it personally. He was completely delusional, not just about me, but about everything all the time. Mm. Like, he got taken to his room and he was given medication. But he wasn't aggressive towards me after that. And he tried to apologize to me in a kind of way. It didn't really make sense because he couldn't really speak properly.
Yeah.
But I knew he felt bad and I didn't take it personally.
These psychotic delusions are fascinating, aren't they? People believing something that's just not the case. Mm. Are there any common themes that people believe?
Yeah, yeah. So I'd say that the ones that I see the most, because their delusions lead to violence, tend to be paranoia. So it's either that people are watching me, following me, want to kill me, either like, you know, people in general, like everybody. And think about that. If you genuinely believe that, it must be absolutely terrifying.
Yeah.
So you can kind of understand why somebody would react violently if you genuinely thought the whole world
was... It'd be like living in a zombie apocalypse or something. Yeah, yeah, everyone's there to get you, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's what it's really like. Mm. So people poisoning their food... cameras being hidden, being followed by like spies or FBI, those things are really common. The other thing, quite interestingly to me, is like religious delusions. So I've seen loads of people who are transfixed with religious delusions who are not actually religious themselves. So they're not, it's almost like hell and damnation and brimstone and fire seeps into their consciousness because it very much aligns with being paranoid, isn't it? So,
wow.
And you might find this interesting. When the COVID occurred, I met two or three patients who had like incorporated COVID into their delusions. So one man I saw actually believed that he was COVID. He believed that he was like the bacteria and that the whole world was, you know, trying to get rid of him through these vaccines. So he became really paranoid. Another one believed that, you know, that everybody around him had COVID and he can give people COVID by looking at them. So he was like literally trying not to look at anybody because that's what he genuinely believed. So
that's nice that he didn't want to give it to people.
Yeah, right? Yeah, that's sweet. Yeah. But I'm just making the point that psychotic people, sometimes they absorb what's going on in the world around them. So they see these new stories and it kind of immerses itself into their psyche.
It's like, is there such a thing as like people believe in their God and believe in their Messiah? Is that common?
That's complex. People always say Messiah complex is like a thing, don't they?
Yeah, but I think Messiah complex in how we sort of use it.
But can there be like an actual...
They think they're so great is what we're saying.
But you'd think there is like a deeper version of that.
Yeah, so as you say, Messiah complex is more of a sort of narcissistic personality thing, whereas a delusion of grandeur can be that you've got special powers or that you're in some way... sort of special or religious. I've seen at least three or four people that believe that they're some sort of incarnation of Jesus. Yeah.
How do you convince somebody who's hearing voices that they're not hearing voices? Because to them they are, aren't they? So that's like you now telling me and utterly trying to convince me that we're not sat at a bright yellow table. How do you do that?
Yeah, you don't. So you can't argue against a psychotic belief or a delusion or an experience. You can medicate against it and you can get people to work around or live with them. But I don't think you can convince somebody who's experiencing something that it's not real for them.
That's quite scary, isn't it, as well? Like, especially like you see it where it just seems to come on randomly. There's a lot of things that we were talking on the way up here, weren't we, that we're worried that like the brain is such a delicate thing. Like you could just wake up one day and now you suddenly believe something else. Obviously you've got the trauma and stuff that can cause it, but even a knock to the head could suddenly make you look at life completely differently. Mm. That's quite scary.
Do mentally unwell people know they're mentally unwell?
So the kind of the blunt answer to that is that we split mental illnesses into neuroses and psychoses. So neuroses, you do have insight, so you know you're unwell. You know if you're depressed, you know if you're anxious, you know if you've got OCD, you know if you've got post-traumatic stress disorder. Mm. And the psychoses, like schizophrenia, sometimes bipolar, depending on what form of it you have, is where you have, you're out of touch with reality, but you don't know that you are, so you lack insight. So the paranoia that you feels really real. Voices that you hear sound real, like you're hearing my voice, they're external. So as an aside, people always like in, you know, rap videos and films, and it's the voices in my head. It's never in your head, it's out your head. You hear it externally, like you're hearing my voice now.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so that's another way you can tell if somebody's like fabricating.
Oh, because they'll naturally say it's like a thought to them, but it's not.
Or they say they hear it like literally in their ear.
But it's like someone's talking to them.
How often are these delusions harmful compared to being harmless?
I think the vast majority of the times they're harmless, by far. But, you know, I don't know the exact percentage, but probably over 90% of the time. But the ones that are dangerous are the ones that, you know, go on to commit violence and the ones that I see. So I think I've got a skewed perspective. So I just want to make a point to your viewers that I don't, you know, I wouldn't want to push the agenda or add to the stigma that mentally ill people are dangerous because they're not. It's just the ones that are the ones that I assess.
Right. That's fair enough. Well, who's the most dangerous person you've ever had to assess or work with?
I suppose it depends. I'm hesitant to answer that only because it depends how you define like violence or danger. Mm. So I mentioned before that I've seen a few women who've killed their own children. So one case that I talk about in my book is this lady called Yasmin. That's not her real name. I give her a pseudonym to hide her identity. And it was one of the most shocking cases that I've ever been involved in. And it's the first time I gave evidence at the Old Bailey for a murder trial.
The first time?
Yeah.
Throwing in at the deep end.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it was. I think it's because there's so many aspects to the case that I could learn from that my consultant, so I was a middle grade doctor at the time.
Okay.
And my consultant just thought, you know, he's going to learn a lot from this and he might not see a case like this for years again. So mm-hmm. the opportunity.
Right.
I'm grateful for. So she's called Yasmin. She was 18 years old. And unlike the vast majority of my patients, she didn't have a history of antisocial behavior. She didn't have any mental health problems. And she became psychotic very quickly over the space of a couple of weeks. And there were some odd warning signs, there were some odd behavior. We call it prodrome. So it's like a phase before actual psychosis. So she was like listening to these weird chanting musics instead of pop music. She was like wearing these really weird hippie kind of clothes. She's everything about her just changed a little bit, but nothing was violent or aggressive.
Is that a common thing you see with people that are developing this?
A prodrome, yeah. So when people become psychotic, usually there's a 2 or 3 week period where they just act strange. They're not fully psychotic, but they have weird experiences and beliefs. So they see, they don't like hear voices, but they like feel distractible, they hear like humming sounds. So it's like a fairly quick build up to state, yeah. And she was babysitting her 2-year-old nephew and she basically smothered him and killed him because she had these psychotic beliefs that I truly believe that she was invested in. She believed at the time that he had demons inside of him. So very similar to that case of Andrea Yates. And she believed that she could reincarnate him. So she had paranoid delusions about demons and grandiose delusions about her ability to bring him back to life. And a bit like Andrea, she didn't try and hide it. She didn't believe that he was dead. So her mum came home. They all lived together. Her mum, the grandmother of the baby, the toddler, and obviously called the police. And then she got arrested. She was in Holloway Prison back then. So that's where I assessed her. And she was very guarded, very evasive. So she wouldn't she refused to accept that the child had died. And upon my evidence, so the CPS were trying to get her on a murder charge, she would have been in prison for the rest of her life, which I think was absolutely wrong. Outcome. So upon my evidence, she got a hospital order to go to a medium secure unit and she was there for many years for rehabilitation. It took about 18 months for us to medicate her psychotic belief. So for that entire time, she didn't believe that she killed her nephew. It was only after the psychosis eventually cleared that she finally understood what she did. And as you'd expect, there's like this tidal wave of guilt and shame. And she had to get through that. And then her brother, who's the father of the child that died, was also part of the rehabilitation. So they'd have this like family therapy session once a week and I'd sit in on that. And it's obviously really, really emotional trying to see them reconnect.
That's an element that we don't really think of as the public. Like you think, oh, she killed her baby, like she's just evil or whatever. Yeah. But the moment when sort of that mist clears, so to speak, and then she realizes what she's done, that's got to be pretty intense as well. Yeah, it's quite sad. Do you think every serial killer in history has had a mental illness, or do you think some of them just bloody love killing?
What a way to say it.
Bloody love of murdering.
I can't stop murdering.
It's my favourite thing. So it depends how you define mental illness, right? So if you're looking at it from the perspective of a psychiatrist like myself, then I would say that it has to be a definable mental illness where there are symptoms and there are treatments, like schizophrenia. Absolutely, most serial killers don't have that. Definitely not. If you look at it from the perspective as somebody doing something that's ununderstandable and really extreme that nobody else would do or the average person could understand, if you count that as a mental illness, which I wouldn't, then yeah, all serial killers have that. Probably the most important definition is the legal definition. So it's not mine or the layperson's definition. It's the law, which is the defense of like diminished responsibility, which is changes murder to manslaughter, or not guilty by reason of sanity, which is for any offense. And it just completely eradicates responsibility. And for that to happen, you either don't know what you're doing or you don't know what you're doing is wrong. So if you're a serial killer, well, almost by definition, serial killers kind of have to cover their tracks, right?
Yeah.
Carry on serial killing. So the very fact that you've done that proves that you knew what you were doing was wrong.
Right.
So it's almost impossible for a serial killer to have that psychiatric defense.
There we go.
So would you just class them as a psycho?
Some of them are psychopaths, not necessarily all of them, because so Ted Bundy is a perfect example of a serial killer who's a psychopath because he was charming and he was manipulative. He manipulated his victims to come, usually young women, to to go with him or go on dates, etc. Whereas some serial killers didn't do any of the manipulation. They just had this frenzy for killing, so they're not psychopaths. Like, they lack empathy, but they're not manipulative.
So what would they be classed as? Like, one that's not really interacting. They're just going, I want to do a murder today.
I don't think there is necessarily any psychiatric diagnoses for them. Some of them will have antisocial personality disorder. So that's like the younger brother of psychopathy. So it is the lack of empathy, the impulsivity, but without, and potentially the violence, but without the charming and manipulation.
So are they the kind of people that you maybe just class as evil?
Yeah. I wouldn't use the term evil, but that's basically what it means, yeah.
Can you get, you said that's like the younger brother. Can you get like a...
Older brother?
Yeah. can you get...
Should we do a family tree?
Can you get like a small, I don't know the right way to phrase it, but like a lesser mental illness where it's like, oh, I'm not going to kill someone, but I'm going to act like this. Will it always eventually develop worse and worse, or can it stay at a certain lower level than...
Definitely can stay at a low level. So another way of saying that is that the vast majority of people with all of these disorders we're talking about, antisocial personality sort of psychopathy, the vast majority of them don't kill.
Right.
With antisocial personality disorder, they're probably violent. And with psychopaths, if it suits them to be violent, they'll be violent. But the vast majority, like, I only see the tip of the iceberg. There's a lot more people that suffer from these things that don't commit any of violence, or certainly not severe violence.
Talking of tip of the iceberg... Eating eyeballs is a note that you kindly gave us prior to the interview.
My God, that's all you've written in, Brad. Yeah. Eating eyeballs.
Is that? Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, he didn't eat them. He pulled them out though.
Okay. I don't know where I got eating from.
His own or someone?
So one of the most extreme cases that I saw, and I should say that I saw this guy years afterwards. So it wasn't like it was about 2 years before he actually did what he did, and when I assessed him. Mm. So he was trying to sue the prison that he was in for not keeping him safe because he became psychotic. So I'll give you a bit of the background. Mm. He was in his 50s, I believe, and he was not a career criminal by any means. He was actually quite depressed. He set a fire in his house, and he got arrested for that, for like arson with recklessness, I think, because nobody else died, but they could have died because it was in like a block of flats. Mm-hmm. He was serving a prison sentence for that. Other prisoners immediately took a disliking to him. I think he was just a little bit old and posh and just didn't carry himself like the other prisoners did. They just disliked him, started bullying him. They spread this rumour, it's untrue, two rumours actually. One, that he was a paedophile, which wasn't true. And secondly, that he'd killed his girlfriend in the blaze, which also wasn't true. And because this rumor kind of spread through the prison, he started getting bullied and targeted, because I'm sure you know, people that offend against children plus people that hurt women are seen as like the lowest of the low in the prison hierarchy.
So right.
He was getting attacked, punched randomly. And the stress of all of this made him psychotic, which, as I said before, is very unusual for somebody in their 50s to become psychotic. It's usually sort of in your late teens, early 20s, but it does happen.
Could it be the punching to the head that's caused that as well, or not?
Possibly, but I think it's probably more likely the stress, the fact that he probably actually genuinely felt that his life was under threat.
That's a lot to happen very quickly.
Yeah, and he's in prison, so it's not like
you can hide behind so him. Much so, has changed, yeah.
So he became psychotic, and he had this delusional belief that... So he didn't eat his own eyeballs, but he believed that other prisoners wanted to remove his eyeballs and eat them because he thought that that would give them the superhuman strength that would let them break out of prison. And so he thought that they would kill him to get his eyeballs. So the only way that he could stop this happening was to remove his eyeballs himself and give it to the prisoners, because then they wouldn't kill him. So he genuinely believed that. And he removed one of his eyeballs with a plastic knife. And then that snapped, so he couldn't use it for the second one, and he removed the other one with his fingers.
Oh, he managed to remove both as well.
Oh, no.
And so he was in a segregation unit, the seg unit. I know you talked to Vanessa about that. So one of the nurses actually literally saw him do this, but she very reasonably didn't want to go into the room because this guy's really, really dangerous.
Yeah.
So by the time she called like the riot squad, and they got kitted up in about 8 minutes, which is actually pretty good, I think. You know, that to run from other parts of the prison. By the time they entered the cell, he'd already...
That's long enough for him to do it.
Yeah. But he was trying to sue the prison for not psychiatrically assessing him properly, as in he should have been like, you know, probably wouldn't have been sectioned, because it takes months to get somebody into the hospital, but he could have at least been taken to healthcare, you know, he could have been given medications.
Is that case kind of a perfect example why you do what you do? Because prisons aren't equipped to be able to deal with patients, or rather than a prisoner, a patient in a way. Yeah. So is it just really important to you to go, like, this is not the right place for this person to be? They need help.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd say in that one particular case, and this was my finding for my assessment, it couldn't have been prevented because he was actually very guarded and he wasn't really letting on to his paranoid beliefs. So this happened, I can't remember, I think it was on a Sunday, and the very first time that he complained of any problems was on a Friday. So this happened within the space of 2 days.
Wow, and he went straight to the extreme.
Yeah, I think he was psychotic a few days before then, but he didn't tell anybody. So like,
as you said, they wouldn't know. If he's paranoid, he's not going to want to tell anyone.
Exactly, yeah.
Is there a chance that because he's in prison, he's getting involved in drugs like spice and stuff like that?
Yeah, there's a chance, but we do urine tests on most individuals when they present like that, and he didn't have anything in his urine in this particular case. Yeah. And also, I don't think the other prisoners would have given him drugs. Actually, they might have done the money, but they certainly weren't helping him out, let's put it that way.
How common is sort of self-harm when people are suffering?
So it's pretty common in the patient group that I see. So about 10% of everybody with schizophrenia ends up taking their own lives. That's a really high proportion.
Wow.
Yeah. Obviously, because I work in secure units, I see people who are more prone to violence than suicide, but it's absolutely pretty high in my patient cohort. Yeah.
Do they tend to choose to go violence on themselves because they're worried of doing it on other people, or is it a mix of...
So there are absolutely some people who do self-harm and internalise their frustrations themselves, absolutely. But again, they're not the people that I see because to come into one of my units, you have to have a history of violence.
What's been an extreme case of self-harm? We're going to put a disclaimer at the start so people already know, but have you seen some bad stuff?
Yeah. So two things immediately come to my mind, two cases. One was actually a woman who took her own life in a psychiatry unit that I was working in. So this was when I was a very junior doctor, and it was in Edinburgh actually. And so this kind of came out of nowhere. So she was in her 40s, she had two teenage children, and she got really unwell really quickly. So she was, within a space of like a couple of months, she'd gone from functioning pretty normally. She had this cancer diagnosis, but it was like, well, actually no, she had a cancer scare, but she was actually clear with the scans. But for some reason, that triggered something. She became obsessed. She didn't believe that she didn't have cancer. She thought she did. And then it just sort of sent her down a spiral. And I think she wanted to end her life before, in her head, she was going to die from cancer.
So right.
Hung herself on a ward. There's a rota of like junior doctors that work the night shift. You don't really have to do that much unless there's an emergency like this on that night. And I got called and to the ward, and she was dead. She'd hung herself with a kettle cord. And the reason that it really stands out to me, obviously, apart from what happened, was that I had to tell her husband what had happened. So the husband got called in. Usually the consultant does it, but the consultant on call lived too far away. So he was there and wanted to speak to somebody. And I thought it was unfair to make him wait for the consultant for like another hour. So I had to go and tell him. That was like really emotionally charged for me.
I bet that never gets easier as well.
Yeah, and one thing that really kind of sticks out from that experience is I remember only like a week before or 2 weeks before telling him that she would get better, because I only thought that she would.
Yeah.
And I just felt like a nice thing to say to him at the time, so I said that. And I remember thinking, sitting there in the room, like, I remembered saying that to him.
Like, yeah. Sort of just, you can never foresee something like that happening, can you, really? Like, what, again, in your notes, you said about seeing two defendants with eerily similar presentations.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
You mean the people who committed murder who'd shot themselves, that one?
Yeah.
So this is just a strange coincidence. They were both within a year of each other, I think. They just happened to be really similar. So one had killed multiple partners. This is the third female partner that he killed. Once the police couldn't really prove what happened because there was very little evidence, and he said it was in self-defense. And I don't think they prosecuted him properly, to be honest, but he got a very short sentence. The second time he got a psychiatric defense, this was years before I saw him, and he was in a psychiatric unit for many years.
Was this in the UK?
Yeah, right. London, yeah. And the third time was when I assessed him. So I saw him in Belmarsh and he basically attacked his partner with a hammer and killed her. And then he tried to commit suicide straight afterwards. So he jumped in front of a bus and ended up becoming sort of paraplegic, had his legs, his arms and his legs had to be amputated because of the severity of the injuries. So I saw him in Belmarsh and it was just very surreal to see somebody who'd done something so horrific, you know, but looked actually pretty vulnerable. Like, he was in his 50s,
wow, yeah.
Small, slight man without any limbs. And it was just really hard to piece together what he'd done versus what you saw.
Yeah.
But I didn't think he had a psychiatric defense. I didn't think he knew exactly what he was doing. And then about a year after that, I saw a farmer who had, was a bit depressed, was splitting up with his wife. She was with another man. He saw them together in a pub. They all lived in a pretty small kind of village, so everyone kind of knew each other. Saw them together in a pub, followed her home, shot her with a shotgun in front of their teenage son, then turned around and tried to kill himself with a shotgun, put it in his mouth. And But instead of killing himself, he just like blew the side of his face off. So when I saw him in a prison in Manchester, he was like, yeah, completely deformed. He'd had surgery and stuff. He'd been in prison, but he'd been in hospital for several weeks for his injuries. But he couldn't speak. He was like communicating through like an iPad to me. So.
Is that hard for you to be able to kind of like, is it diagnose like someone with, if they're just talking to you through a screen?
You know what? It's not that I can't get the symptomatology, it's that it's so slow. It was like frustratingly slow.
Oh, yeah.
Like, obviously, I don't want to be a dick and rush it, but at the same time, it's like I'd ask one question and it would take him like, you know, 4 or 5 minutes just to type up the answer. But to, you know, what he did was horrific without question, but to, I was going to say to his credit, I don't know if that's the right phrase, but to be fair to him, he said from the beginning that there's no psychiatric defense. I really regret what I did. It was, you know, I was in a jealous rage. He was a bit drunk at the time. I wish I was dead. You know, I'm not trying to absolve responsibility. I did it.
Was the guy who jumped in front of the bus open, or was he trying to go down there?
I think he was trying to exaggerate a lot of his depression. And I mean, that's fine. He might be depressed. He might not. And I think he probably was. But that's not what's important to me. What's important to me is, did he know what he was doing at the time? He clearly did.
And finally, can you tell us the story of a man trying to catch a flight?
yeah. So this is just... I'd never laugh at a patient, but this scenario was quite amusing for me.
Mm-hmm.
He had these psychotic beliefs that he had loads of grandiose ideas, and one of them was that he was going to go to Africa. I think it was the country of origin of some of his family, because he wanted to fight various wild animals, and he had like this vision of fighting this bear, and he was literally going to do it. Like, he was acting very bizarrely in Heathrow, I believe it was, and that's why he was stopped, and the police officers were talking to him, and they thought there was something wrong with him. And then it turned out he had this like long history of like other violent incidents that all happened, so he got resectioned into our hospital. But the reason that kind of stands out to me was because one of his many bizarre delusions was that he had like his urine had special power. So he would just basically piss on his clothes and then like leave them in different parts of the ward to like ward off evil energy and evil spirits.
Oh, wow.
So that was just a weird thing to like go into work every day.
Wow,
just,
I bet you've read some.
Unusual.
And there were some surreal things. You mentioned there was two different categories at one point. There was
psychoses and neuroses, yeah.
That one. And the psychoses one is when people aren't aware that they have a mental illness.
Yeah.
Is it possible for somebody to go through a state of... being psychotic for a while, then come out of that and then look back on that state and know that they were different then?
Yeah. So yes, absolutely. So for example, you can have drug-induced psychosis. Like if you smoke too much really strong cannabis or take speed, as I said before, those are the substances that cause it more than anything else. So that is a temporary period of psychosis. And you can come out of that fairly quickly once it's left your system. As to whether so usually people that I've talked to, they have very patchy kind of memories. It's kind of being a bit like in a dreamlike state. I suppose it's not too different from being like blind drunk. I mean, I'm not saying the same thing's not, but it's similar in that you vaguely remember what was going on, but it doesn't feel like it was you. It feels like a different experience.
Right.
This doesn't kind of follow on from any of that, but I'm intrigued by it. We've spoken about like psychopaths, sociopaths, messiah complex and all that. We touched very quickly on narcissism.
Yeah.
Being a narcissist, is that like what kind of level is that within everything? Because we use it quite openly, going, oh, he's just narcissistic, like kind of like as a way to insult someone in a way. But is there something more serious and deeper within that?
Yeah, absolutely. So narcissistic as an adjective doesn't necessarily mean that much. That's just describing somebody that's a bit up themselves. But narcissistic personality disorder is a psychiatric diagnosis, right? So like all personality disorders, if your traits are so extreme that it affects your functioning and your relationship, then by definition, you have that diagnosis, right? So somebody with narcissistic personality disorder is not only really grandiose, but they constantly seek reassurance. They cannot tolerate any form of criticism, and they completely lack empathy for people around them. In a different way to psychopaths, they don't want to hurt you, but they just don't care about you and your problems. So if you've got somebody, a friend who's a proper narcissist or has narcissistic PD, they are the kind of person that always brings drama. They will, like, you try and tell them about your day, your problems, and the conversation will very quickly turn around to them and their problems. They kind of absorb all the emotion out of any situation. So somebody that does that to the degree that they can't hold down normal relationships, or they can't hold down, you know, a job or can't function properly, that's narcissistic personality disorder.
Could we finish real quickly about two real life cases, which I'm sure you didn't personally work on, but just to get your opinion. Lucy Letby.
Yeah.
This is a very strange one, that,
yeah,
isn't it?
It's very strange.
What's your thoughts on that?
What's going on there? Yeah.
Yeah.
So I've been on a couple of news programs, and basically everybody has asked me, why did she do what she did? It's the ultimate question. And the honest truth is, Jack, is I don't know. What I can say is that she doesn't fit into any category that's typical for somebody that does something like that. So obviously, to be a caregiver and to take the life of innocent babies itself is pretty horrific. So you have to kind of, you know, lack empathy, obviously. But what surprises me is there's no psychopathology to go on. There's nothing odd about her or her personality that we know of. So she didn't have any problems with her work colleagues. She was actually seen as quite a conscientious nurse before any of this happened. Mm. She doesn't have a history of trauma. She doesn't have issues with relationships, whether romantic or friendship. She's not someone that falls out with people. So she doesn't have any of the sort of red flags or warning signs of somebody that would commit such a level of violence. She wasn't exposed to violence, as far as we know, when she was younger. So to me, it's a bit like being presented, I said something at Lab Bible as well, it's a bit like being presented with a dead body as a pathologist without any injuries and somebody asking me, how did this person die? I don't know. I do not know I cannot see or fathom why she did what she did. My best guess is that she's somehow jealous of other families and other family units because it's something that she didn't have herself. But that in itself doesn't even necessarily.
So she had time to still get that.
Yeah, that doesn't look like lots of people feel that, but people want to do that. So I don't know.
I don't know if I'm oversimplifying it, but that sounded more towards the Bundy side of things that you were saying, like how he seemed completely normal to everyone else, but wanted to go and do these horrific things.
Yeah.
But you can kind of like Bundy's getting something out of it though. Mm. Like, do you know what I mean?
So she hasn't been diagnosed with anything, has she?
No, I think she had a bit of anxiety and a bit of depression during the trial, but nothing that's first of all severe and secondly that would have explained.
Yeah, isn't that just what most people would have if they
because I'd literally just read that apparently she's cozying up in prison with another child murderer and becoming friends of one.
What I really like about you, and I'm not sure if it's your whole profession that's like this, is the fact that you're sitting here saying, I don't know. You're not thinking, I'm a forensic psychiatrist, I should have an answer to this.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that common in your work that there are cases and times when you're just like, we don't know?
Is it Socrates that said that the true knowledge is knowing that you know nothing?
You think I know the answer to that?
You think you know Socrates? Yeah. He thinks he's a footballer.
Yeah. Yeah, we call it football over here, mate.
The old defender for Arsenal.
So I think, first of all, I'd like to think I'm not so egotistical that I feel like I have to be right all the time, that I know the answer to everything, because I don't. Mm. Number one. And number two, to be a good expert witness, you get cross-examined by the barrister from the other side, right? If you're a defence, you get cross-examined by the CPS, and vice versa. And you are setting yourself up to be professionally embarrassed if you're very arrogant and if you think that you know the answer to something that you don't know. So when I'm doing a court report, I will say, either if I don't know the answer to something, I'll say it. So for example, say if Joker was a hypothetical real patient of mine, I would say this is a neurological disorder and I can't comment on this. Because if I get cross-examined and they say, tell me about this disorder, and then I rattle on 5 minutes, what training have you had in neurology? You know, name me one paper that you've written about this disorder, and then I'd be like torn to shreds, basically. So
yeah.
You shouldn't never overstep your mark as an expert witness. But also because sometimes I think there's a grey area. So for example, if there's a case where I think there's some indications that somebody was psychotic, but there's also equally some indication that maybe they weren't, what I do, and I think a good expert witness should do, is I put down all my workings, like maths GCSE. So I'll say, these are things that are for that, my theory, and these are things that are against it. This is a reasonable range of opinions, and this is where my opinion lies on that for these reasons. So I'm kind of used to doing that. So if you think like that, your point is not to be right or to win a case. Your purpose is to explain what the court doesn't know.
Super fascinating.
Does that mean you have to be overly cautious/worried that if you're being cross-examined, there's a chance that this prosecutor will kind of stand there and go, well, actually, on the Happy Hour podcast, you said this. So is there a chance that they'll look into your YouTube channel? Look, the second they know you're going to be on the bench, they're going to search your name. They're going to see that you've been on this podcast, that you've done this YouTube video. They're going to analyze everything you've ever said. Mm. So do you have to like make sure you're like, okay, I need to make sure I'm saying things correctly?
Can we just edit out this entire interview? Honestly, I don't know. I suppose it's possible. Yeah, there's no legal reason why they wouldn't be able to.
Yeah, because I guess the more you do public things like Lad Bible and stuff, that then got this stuff that they can look at and go, Well, you're saying this in court, but you said this. Obviously, you're not. You're sticking to your guns and you're saying exactly how you feel about things. But I guess there could then be that worry. You're thinking, delete the YouTube channel.
It's possible. Yeah.
A case that Fiona's is fascinated by, and I will admit I don't know much about it, but she's asked me to ask you, is Gypsy Rose Blanchard. Have you heard of this?
I have, yes.
Yeah, she's just been released from prison.
She has Munchausen by proxy. Well, what's that?
What is that? So I have actually made a video about this a long time ago, so I can't remember all the details well, but I can tell you what that disorder is. So it is basically where somebody... So Munchausen's is where you fake mental illness. You fake illness, usually physical illness, but you do it because you want to be in the victim or the patient role, I should say. So you like the attention that you're getting. You like people. You take on the role of being sick so that people can give you sympathy and empathy around you. And typically, if you don't get what you want from hospitals, like you don't get the diagnosis that you want, you fake things. So you consciously fake blood test results, or you fake your own injuries, or you injure yourself, or you doctor shop. So if a doctor says, you've been here 5 times and I've told you there's nothing wrong with your abdominal pain, then you go to another hospital. You might even change your name so that you get lost in the system. So Munchausen by proxy is all of that, but you do it to somebody else, typically a mother doing it to a child.
Why would the mother want that? I can understand why the individual would want the attention.
Yeah.
Why would the mother want that?
I think they just like the attention by proxy, for want of a better word. So they like the attention because they're still very much part of it, isn't it? Especially if the child's quite young, they're the person that is still getting called and is part of the whole process.
So that was her case, wasn't it? So her mother did it to her, Gypsy Rose
Convinced
Blanchard.
Convinced that she was poorly.
Gypsy then maybe convinced her boyfriend to kill her own mum, which he's now in prison for, but she's now been released, even though she convinced. I'm not 100% on it, but it does seem a bit strange. She's now blowing up online, isn't she?
She's in prison by proxy, isn't she?
But she's now gained a big following. People are posting about how she...
for it, don't they? Because what her mother put her through was so horrific and so torturous. Mm. A lot of people... I mean, I made a video about her years ago, and some of the YouTube comments were, I'd have done exactly the same thing, or just said very nasty, derogatory things about the mum much more than about Gypsy.
But then she's done this with the boyfriend, and she's now left prison and got with a new guy. So that other guy's done that for her, and he's just in prison.
Madness.
That's all a bit strange, isn't it?
Very strange.
As expected from all of these cases.
What's catatonia?
Catatonia. It's actually there's a Welsh rock band called Catatonia, but that's not...
Okay.
That's what Jack was asking about, actually.
That's a coincidence. So catatonia is a very rare psychiatric disorder. So it's associated with either intense schizophrenia or really severe depression. And it's where somebody completely loses their movement and their volition. So there's different forms, but the more interesting form, I think I've seen it twice in my career. Yeah, twice, is where you get somebody who just absolutely cannot move. So they're literally stood still as a board. And there's a thing called waxy flexibility. So if you change their limbs into a different position, they'll stay there. So if you have somebody with catatonia and you put their arms up like this and you walk away, they'll just literally stay there.
And this is a real thing?
Yeah, it's a real thing. It's very, very rare nowadays because it usually happens when somebody's untreated for months and months and months. So usually people, when they're becoming unwell, they'll get assessed and they'll get treated. So it used to happen a few decades ago. You very rarely see it now. But I've seen it a couple of times, and it is very fascinating, quite terrifying to watch. Because I've seen one of the times I didn't get to see him very, very much because I was just visiting another clinic. But the second time I was in one of these secure units. So this guy had set a fire a couple of months before, had gone to prison and became catatonic whilst he was in prison. And he got taken to our ward, and he was literally getting spoon-fed by the nurses because he wouldn't move. If you left him in his chair, he would not get up to eat or to use the toilet. He would rot.
How long? Why, just stay forever?
No, you can medicate it. So it actually responds relatively quickly to medicine. So antipsychotics typically take 4 or 6 weeks to work. In catatonia, they tend to be a bit quicker. It's number.
Oh, okay.
When they're in that state, how are they with their eyes? Are they following you around the room? Are they blinking?
Absolute dead stare. Yeah.
Can they blink?
I think they probably could if you were I've never tried to blow into their eyes. No, I'm not sure if you did that. But if you're interested, I've got a reaction video on my YouTube channel to somebody who's got catatonia. So I'm It's quite a viral video, the original video, but I just like comment on all the different symptoms.
Like, does that mean they don't feel discomfort? Because like you said, if you lifted their arm up, it would just stay there. I can hold my hand up for a little bit of time, but as soon as it starts to feel uncomfortable because the blood's obviously moving down the wrong way, whatever, like I need to bring it down. Like, would they just keep it there?
Just keep it there.
Well, I guess if they're not going to eat because they're not feeling discomfort of being hungry, or if they're feeling it, their brain's not registering it correctly.
And would they just go to the toilet?
They'd probably soil themselves. So it's a bit like being in a coma, but being
awake to it. It's like the sleep paralysis.
Yeah.
It's constantly there.
And finally, Stockholm syndrome.
Yeah.
What is that?
So that is something that's also very, very rare. It's usually a reaction to like a kidnapping situation. And it's quite hard to understand psychologically. I think the best way that I could describe it is when somebody goes through a terrifying, life-threatening situation and they're shown a tiny bit of kindness, or they genuinely think they're going to die, and then the relief at not dying because your kidnapper shows you a bit of kindness,
right?
You become emotionally connected to it. And the reason it's called Stockholm Syndrome, I believe, is because a few people from a particular bank robbery that occurred in Stockholm decades ago had this symptom, and they're actually defending the bank robbers. So they were trying to, like, they were refusing to give testimony, and they were trying to, like, excuse the behaviour of the bank robbers.
Wow. This has been absolutely fascinating, mate. What's 2024 got in store for you, Dr. Beth?
2024, I'm going to continue my medico-legal criminal work because it fascinates me, and I'm going to try and muscle my way into the YouTube world if I can.
Love it. And once again, tell our listeners and our viewers where they can check out your stuff, because I've dipped in and out, and it's this, but on steroids.
And you don't have to have us on it.
You don't have to.
It's us, but without all the stupid parts.
Yeah, yeah.
Less questions about porn.
That's his next video.
Yeah, where can people find
it? So my YouTube channel is called A Psych for Sore Minds.
Great name.
I dissect a whole smorgasbord of issues to do with mental illness and offending, like individual cases that we've talked about and sort of broad topics. And I've got a book. I've actually bought you a copy as a gift.
Oh, amazing. Thank you.
Minds, which is similar to the common cases we've discussed. So my own personal cases, I anonymize them and just talk the reader through the journey of what it was like to be a forensic psychiatrist.
Thank you so much for coming on, mate. This has been Jackmate's Happy Hour podcast with me, Jackmate, Stevie White and Shoham Das. What is, we ask everyone this, just to finish, what is the meaning of life?
That's a good question. I think the meaning of life is to fulfill your own potential, and your potential changes depending on what you've done before you. So it's different for different people. So I've got a meaning of life right now, which might be to do with my media. You've probably got slightly different goals. So it is not just to sit on your laurels and do the easy thing and take the passive least resistance, but to push yourself and do something that you really want to do, but it's quite easy to get discouraged from doing.
What an answer.
That was a lovely answer.
He's too smart for us. Bring on the YouTubers.
Do you watch porn?
No comment.
Jackmate's Happy Hour.